comedians and best-selling authors.
It's the fastest way to change things. You do need politics, but if you want to change something overnight, culture is the quickest way to do it.
Conversations, not newsy interrogations. The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Saturday evening at 5:30. Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday the 5th of September. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, good to have your company and be with you. The headlines today. Water company bosses will be held to account for sewage spills with bonus bans and even jail time under new government legislation unveiled this morning. The Prime Minister has said the Grenfell report will be a moment of change for the country. We'll talk to the Deputy Prime Minister and Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, about what that really means.
Also in today's programme, in a rare interview, the Chief Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court defends his decision to seek the arrest of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes, saying that justice has to be seen to be done.
Do we want for our children to have a world driven by brute power over innocence? Or do we want a world that has a fighting chance to be regulated evenly by something that I think is needed, which is the law?
And what do you think this is worth? That is the sound of Skiddaw Forest in the Lake District, where environmental campaigners have launched a bid to buy the highest nature reserve in the country. All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
Water company executives could be banned from receiving bonuses and sent to jail under new government legislation aimed at reducing pollution. The bill, which will apply in England and Wales, gives regulators more powers and makes it easier for them to impose penalties. Last year, there were more than 450,000 sewage spills in England. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
This legislation makes it easier for the Environment Agency to take enforcement action and introduces tougher penalties for executives. If they obstruct an investigation, they could now face up to 2 years in jail. Bonuses for bosses will only be allowed if their companies are judged by the regulator to have met both environmental and financial standards. Critics say that up till now, the problem hasn't been the laws, but the willingness of the industry regulators to enforce them. The water companies said they agreed the current system was not working. They're calling on the regulators to back their £105 billion investment plan for new infrastructure, paid for through higher customer bills.
A housing minister has warned that not all buildings wrapped in the same type of dangerous cladding that covered Grenfell Tower have been identified. Yesterday's report on the disaster accused companies of deliberately concealing the fire risks posed by their construction materials. Hundreds of high-rise buildings with flammable cladding have been found, still haven't been made safe because of disputes over who should pay for the remedial work. The Housing and Planning Minister, Matthew Pennycook, told Newsnight the government would set out an accelerated programme to tackle the issue this autumn.
We've got to review how leaseholders are better protected from costs. We've got to accelerate the pace of remediation. But looking under the bonnet, we found a number of challenges. For example, we don't know for certain that all of the buildings that are dangerous have been identified. So we've got to do more work in that area. You know, government has a big role to play, and it can't just be left to the market, if you like, and individual developers or building owners to respond. I think government can and should be doing more.
A 14-year-old boy is due to appear in a youth court this morning, charged with the murder of an 80-year-old man in a park in Leicestershire. Bim Coley died in hospital after being attacked in Franklin Park on Sunday while walking his dog. The teenager, who can't be named because of his age, has been remanded in custody. The head of the organisation that represents universities is warning they face a slide into decline unless the government takes action to ease pressure on funding. Dame Sally Mapstone from Universities UK will tell a conference of vice-chancellors that the sector is at a fork in the road. The University and College Union has also called for insecure contracts and pay to be addressed. Here's our education editor, Bramwen Jeffries.
University finances are under pressure. There's been a sharp fall in applications from international students since visa restrictions came into force in January. That's piled on pressure in England, where tuition fees have increased by £250 in the last 12 years, falling far behind inflation. At least 40% of universities are forecasting a deficit in their budgets. In a speech this morning, Professor Dame Sally Mapstone from Universities UK is expected to warn without decisions on funding, institutions face a slide into decline.
The authorities in the US state of Georgia say a 14-year-old boy will be charged with murder after a shooting at a high school yesterday. Two pupils and two teachers were killed. Nine others were taken to hospital from Appalachee High School in Winder near Atlanta. The FBI said agents had interviewed the boy and his father last year for making online threats about a school shooting. Neda Taufik reports.
The gunman was identified by authorities as Colt Gray, a 14-year-old student at the school. They said within minutes of receiving the active shooter alert, two resource officers posted at the school encountered the suspect, who immediately surrendered and was taken into custody. But before that, two students, two teachers were shot and killed. At the moment, authorities have not identified any connection between the gunman and the victims. They said he would be charged with murder and tried as an adult.
A hospice in West Sussex is the latest provider of end-of-life care to announce job losses or a reduction in services. St Catherine's, which is cutting 35 staff posts, is the sixth hospice in recent weeks to take such action because of financial pressures. A council of New Zealand's indigenous Maori chiefs has chosen the late king's youngest child and only daughter as the new queen. 27-year-old Naue Hono Itipo was selected as king Tuheitia's successor in an elaborate ceremony ahead of his funeral. Thousands of mourners gathered on the country's North Island. A flotilla of war canoes carried the late monarch to a sacred mountain for burial.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's 6 minutes past six. I think it's time to get the latest weather forecast, who we can turn to Helen Willits for at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning, Emma. Hello there. Good morning. High pressure to the north and low pressure to the south puts us in an east-northeasterly flow at the moment. It's quite a brisk wind blowing in lots of low cloud to the east today. But let's start further south, southern England and South Wales, where it's going to be cloudy, increasingly humid and quite wet. We could have some large rainfall, total spray, standing water, localised flooding with as much as 60 to 80 millimetres through today, and another dose to come tomorrow. Now that could turn potentially thundery as well across central and southern England, the West Country, and later into the south and east of Wales. So temperatures under the cloud around about 19 or 20, but as I say, feeling humid. Head further north into northern and central Wales and the Midlands. Likely to avoid most of the rain, although it's a bit misty, murky and drizzly in the Midlands this morning. Hopefully that will ease away and we'll see a bit of brightness further west, highs of about 20 degrees. But for northeast England, along with eastern Scotland, that low cloud is going to make things a little bit grey at times. Possibly some drizzly rain, particularly the northeast of England. And temperatures will be limited to 14 or 15 because of that North Sea Coast Ha and Fret here. Now, as we head into Northern Ireland and Western Scotland, it's a different story, closer to that area of high pressure. Yes, we do have a bit of a breeze here, probably not as strong as that brisk wind further south, but we should see plenty of dry weather, a good deal of sunshine, and our temperatures could be highest here, Northern Ireland and Western Scotland, up to 19 to 21 degrees Celsius. So quite a mixed bag, really, today.
Thank you very much indeed, Helen. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers, most leading on the Grenfell report that came out yesterday. The Guardian quotes the findings in its headline, saying the disaster was caused by dishonesty and greed. Its front page and those of many of the morning papers feature pictures of the 72 victims of the fire, excepting those whose images have not been made public. The Times leads on calls from bereaved families for prosecutors to bring charges over the failings. The Express describes the tower as a death trap, alongside a picture of the burning building. The Financial Times tells its readers that warnings about the dangerous cladding were ignored and that manufacturers manipulated testing.
Now, get them justice, demands the Daily Mirror, which points out the latest official figures show that there are still more than 4,600 residential buildings in England with unsafe cladding. The Eyes headline reads, "Everyone failed them." The Daily Mail asks, "Will they ever get justice?" The paper notes the mounting pressure to speed up criminal charges, as does the Daily Telegraph. Its leader column says the inquiry's final report appears to have satisfied no one, and leaves bereaved families waiting many more years for justice if, the paper says, it ever comes. The Sun calls for the people responsible for the fire to be put in the dock.
The Telegraph's lead story focuses on the government's crackdown on water companies over pollution in rivers and seas. Sewage leak water bosses to face 2 years jail, reads its headline. The paper says there's been a public outcry over the regular dumping of sewage into waterways, and ministers believe that by making water companies pay for enforcement action, they can fund a major expansion of the Environment Agency's powers. But it also quotes critics who believe the plans don't go far enough. The campaigner Fergal Sharkey is apparently not sufficiently convinced to call off a mass protest planned for next month.
The Daily Express says some temporary NHS staff fear speaking up about patient safety because they could face discrimination as a result. The paper says a report by the Health Services Safety Investigations Body found that some workers felt isolated and worried about speaking up in case they lose future work opportunities.
A number of today's papers carry the ongoing story of the Oasis reunion after the band hit out against the practice known as dynamic pricing, which saw some tickets go for more than double the advertised price. Definitely not me, says the Daily Mirror. The paper reports that Oasis left all decisions about ticket pricing to their management. Some might replay, reads the Sun's headline. They're trying hard, aren't they? It says the band have pledged a fairer system when tickets for their two extra Wembley shows go on sale.
Oh, I wish I could go. It's not happened. I didn't even try, Nick.
I didn't even try. I tried and tried. Every member of the family, multiple devices.
That's not the memories I want of Oasis. The Times says the Pope has reignited his feud with childless pet owners. It reports that while addressing politicians in Indonesia, Pope Francis said that seeing people there having up to five children is an example for every country, adding that it can't go well when people prefer only to have pets. The paper recalls that last year he scolded a woman for calling her dog her baby. There's lots about childless women and pets, certainly in politics and religion at the moment.
There is. Odd, isn't it?
It's a theme.
Usually cats, though.
Or men.
Mm.
Yes.
11 minutes past six. Now, water company bosses could face up to 2 years in jail for obstructing regulators under new laws being proposed by the government. Let's talk about what that might mean with Jonah Fisher, our climate and environment correspondent. New powers for the regulator, Jonah, but in what circumstances might they be used?
Yeah, well, the government are calling this the most significant increase in enforcement powers in a decade. Some of the headlines, Nick, well, you mentioned their water company bosses being sent to jail. Well, that's perhaps the most headline-catching aspect which is being put forward. That would be in cases in which they were seen to have obstructed investigations. Also, this new legislation would put a conditionality on performance-related pay or bonuses. Of course, some execs have been taking home multi-million dollar pay packages as the sewage has flowed. They can now, under this bill, only be paid if the regulator Ofwat deems the company to have met both environmental and financial standards. Now, that's important because, remember, the water companies have racked up huge debt since privatisation, somewhere in the region of £60 billion, Thames Water, just £15 billion on its own. So there will be a conditionality on bonuses. There's a lot of other things in there. It will also be easier for the Environment Agency to punish water company for offences, so there'll be automatic fines for some things. The burden of proof has been reduced for civil offences from beyond all reasonable doubt to on the balance of probability. So what the government is saying is that will make it much easier for fines and penalties to be issued quickly. It will reduce the need for long investigations.
Just time for a quick last one, Jonah. The water companies, though, say in reply, look, a lot of this is about what things were like 10 years or 20 years ago. We haven't got the money now.
Well, that's effectively been their response. The water body, Water UK, which represents all the water companies, has come out with a statement. It's ignored all these new penalties, all the new laws that might be brought against them. It's talked about one figure, £105 billion. That's the amount that they've asked for over the next 5 years for new infrastructure, which is what they say is going to fix the sewage problem. And of course, the big catch with that is, well, they're going to have to borrow it from somewhere. And who wants to lend to the UK water industry at the moment? And ultimately, it's the bill payers, customer bills, that's going to increase as a consequence. And we've got negotiations going on right now between the regulator Ofwat and the water companies to determine just how much our bills are going to have to rise over the next 5 years to pay for what the water companies want to do.
Jonah Fisher, thank you.
14 minutes past six. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has doubled down on control of Gaza's border with Egypt, insisting Israeli troops must remain in this buffer zone to prevent weapons and possibly Israeli hostages being smuggled across. James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent in Jerusalem. Good morning. Can such a position further dash any remaining hopes of a ceasefire?
Well, at the moment, it's not looking good, simply because both sides are still pretty far apart. And it's all essentially, the main focus is on what kind of role and presence should Israeli forces have in Gaza if there were to be a ceasefire. Hamas say the IDF should simply not be there. But the Israelis are saying, no, there should be an IDF present. And the focus at the moment, at least of the Prime Minister, is on this little strip of land right on the southern border of Gaza and Egypt. The Israelis call it the Philadelphia Corridor. And essentially, Mr. Netanyahu now, for two nights, has given two long press conferences, one for the local media and last night for international media, with charts and maps, basically arguing that Israeli forces have to remain there because if they don't, Hamas will be able to rearm during a ceasefire by bringing weapons in, and they will also be able to take hostages out. Now, Mr. Netanyahu is incredibly insistent about this. The problem is that a chunk of his government disagrees with him. There have been reports in the Israeli media of shouting matches in the cabinet with other ministers saying, look, you simply don't need to do this. There are technological alternatives that suddenly this focus on the Philadelphia corridor has, some people say, has been less important in previous times. There's been less emphasis by Israeli negotiators. There's a dispute which sides are saying different things about whether or not at some stage during the negotiating process the Israeli side actually offered to take troops out of this area. And essentially the critics are suggesting that the Israeli Prime Minister is focusing on this strip of land as another attempt to avoid a deal so that he can essentially buy time so that he potentially could make further gains, military gains, against the Hamas leadership in coming months.
James Landell, diplomatic correspondent in Jerusalem. Thank you.
It is 16 minutes past six. One of the groups Sir Martin Moore Bick singled out for his strongest criticism in the Grenfell Fire report yesterday was the construction industry, saying fundamental change was still needed 7 years on from the disaster. Will Bain has more on that story and the rest of the morning's business news. Morning to you, Will.
Morning, Nick. Morning, Emma. Yeah, Sir Martin, whilst acknowledging some steps had already been taken, did say more needed to be done to bring about that fundamental change. And his recommendations included appointing a regulator to oversee all aspects of the construction industry. Damini Sharma is the CEO and co-founder of the OM Group. It's a consultancy, works with a lot of the big construction firms. It's also a training provider for the construction industry as well. Damini, morning.
Hi, good morning, Will.
First of all, some pretty strong criticism for the sector pretty widely in yesterday's report. Must have made tough reading.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Will. It was very, very difficult to read. It was very difficult to kind of acknowledge that the industry that I'm a part of, that I'm so passionate about, had such a big part to play in such a big tragedy. And it's been known for a long time. It's not something that we weren't expecting. It wasn't a surprise result of the inquiry. It has been known for a long time, but it's still really, really difficult to read.
This call for an overall regulator, does it sound a sensible one to you?
Yeah, well, to be honest, it does. I mean, we've got two regulators that have already been introduced as a result of Dame Judy Hackett's report into the Grenfell tragedy. So we've got the Building Safety Regulator, who are responsible for overseeing the high-risk buildings regime. So they are implementing the golden thread that was recommended and monitoring building safety compliance as a whole. And then we've got the National Construction Products Regulator, who, as Sir Martin alluded to, needed to be tighter controls on the regulation of products that are used on high-rise buildings. So the Construction Products Regulator will be looking at regulating construction products, testing and certifying them. They'll also have enforcement powers. So we've had big steps that have been made in recent years as a result of Grenfell. It's just a shame that this joined-up thinking wasn't in place before. In fact, it's not a shame, it's a tragedy that this joined-up thinking wasn't in place before, and we could have prevented Grenfell.
Yeah, because that was one of the things that really stood out, picking through this section of the report, was just how you know, one body, how disparate everything was. One body for testing some bit of something and then a different body to certify a different bit. Has that improved in the 7 years since Grenfell? Has it become more joined up?
I think it's become more joined up recently since the introduction of the construction products regulator. I think that the industry has sat up and realised that it's made fundamental mistakes. Granted that there were some key players within the industry that made those fundamental mistakes in relation to Grenfell, but there will be other contractors and other suppliers of materials out there who have done very similar to other buildings that haven't had the Grenfell type tragedy that happened in 2017. So they'll be sitting there thinking, oh gosh, you know, that's something that we need to address. So there is more joined up thinking, there is more joined up process in terms of regulating product and material. I think there's a long way to go yet, but I think already for high-rise residential buildings, I think we can safely say that the majority of products are now being put forward. In fact, all of the products that are now being put forward will have been significantly fire or stringently fire tested and will be suitable for use.
The other area where there was a lot of criticism from Sir Martin was broadly about culture, wasn't it? Culture within those companies you mentioned, but culture within the industry, full stop. You work with big partners. You also train new people coming into the industry. Do you get a sense that culture is changing?
Yes. I think there's been a shift in the culture. I think there's been a level of, oh gosh, we're now accountable, which don't get me wrong, they were always accountable in the past, but there was a little bit of a cavalier attitude of, well, you know, how can we take advantage of the light regulatory regime that the UK has?
Because that's the thing, isn't it? Some of the statements from some of the companies involved seem, well, remarkably defensive still, even if they say that they're working with future legal processes, that there does still seem to be some buck passing.
Yeah, absolutely, Will. And do you know what's really, really strange for us in the industry as kind of professionals and working on the professional services side and also the training side is that the UK is looked at by the rest of the world as very, very high in terms of safety standards and has a very low record of injuries and deaths in the construction sector. So we've done really, really well on that. But when we see the level of the level that the contractors and the suppliers were able to get away with and the advantages that they took based on the loopholes that existed in the industry, it leads to us having to consider, well, actually, had this been dealt with and we had the regulatory regime that we should have had and that we now have, hopefully, that would never have happened. Grenfell would never have been allowed to happen.
Damini, thanks so much for your time this morning. Damini Sharma there, the CEO and co-founder of the OM Group. And as I say, all those companies that were singled out in the report, Arconic, Celotex, Kingspan, all saying they're continuing to engage with the future legal processes. Anna McDonald, independent equity analyst, is with us to look at what else is moving financial markets this morning. Anna, morning.
Good morning.
A big announcement from Volvo, scrapping its plans to sell only fully electric cars by 2030. It had been leading the way on this.
Yes, they had said they'd be fully electric, not even hybrid by 2030. And they have now pushed out those targets because they are just seeing changing market conditions. Some of the subsidies that governments had put in place to encourage electric car purchases have ended. And also there's just that ongoing lack of demand because consumers are worried about charging.
Yeah, and they're not the only ones, are they? Volkswagen been talking about this. And last week we saw in financial results, Ford, General Motors in the United States also talking about shifts and delays in this.
Yes. And I mean, it still remains the case that electric cars are more expensive. And whilst the EU and the US are putting tariffs on Chinese cars that are imported to stop them kind of swamping the market, that just means that, you know, vehicles have to be made outside China, which is more expensive in themselves. And the car manufacturers are not keen to start making a loss on these vehicles.
Quick other headline, front of the FT this morning, they certainly think that the idea of this British ISA, something we've talked about a lot in this slot on the programme before, might well be ditched by the government.
Yes, it was always quite a complicated thing to try and implement and administer. It was going to allow an extra £5,000, into, UK equities every year on top of your £20,000 ISA allowance. And yes, it would have been extremely complicated to implement, but it was part of that try and drive more investment into UK equities by both retail investors, and they also need to push that on the public sector as well.
Michael Summersgill, the boss at AJ Bell, quoted in the FT, welcoming that news, something he's told us on the programme before. Anna, thanks so much for your time this morning. Anna McDonald, independent equity analyst there. Now, last week, the chief executive of Kurt Geiger was on this programme telling Sean about his company's expansion into the US. Now, another British chain following suit, the outdoor clothing retailer Mountain Warehouse has just bought a business called Eastern Mountain Sports. Mark Neal is the founder and chief executive of Mountain Warehouse. He told us more.
It's a long-established, well-loved outdoor chain in the US, and we're very excited about it. It sort of was unloved for a while, and it fell into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, but it's got a great DNA, a great heritage, some really, really good people. And we're excited to be taking that on and expanding our business in the US with it.
Yeah, what does it look like? Is it going to keep its branding? Is it going to have your branding? What are the practicalities?
No, we're definitely buying it for its brand, which is so well known, and particularly in the northeast of the United States. Mountain Warehouse has been trading in the US for 10 years now. We already have a profitable business there, but it's relatively small in the grand scheme of things, and particularly in the context of the size of the market there. The United States is the biggest outdoor market in the world, and we think that this acquisition can help us to expand there more quickly.
Is that because you've been so successful here? Are you at sort of saturation in the UK? Are you looking for new places to open that aren't here?
We are, but we're still investing in the UK, actually. You know, and we're investing more in the UK than anywhere else still. And we have a long pipeline. I think between now and the end of the year, we're opening roughly one store a week.
How do you persuade, or do you try and persuade people down to those high streets, I guess, that are having more difficulty, where you're one of the last people standing?
It's very difficult when a high street gets to a, you know, a particular tipping point, because, you know, retailers all depend on each other being there, don't they? I mean, it's no good if we're the only shop in town. We need everybody else. We need the coffee shops, but we also need other retailers. So certain high streets become clearly quite difficult. You know, in some cases, we have had to close some high street stores and move to out of town parks nearby. But we're still investing in high streets as well.
Is there a good practice somewhere that you think could be replicated, could be copied in bits of the country to keep propping up and boosting high streets?
The most challenging thing in difficult high streets is business rates. Business rates have become completely disproportionate to the turnover that a business can achieve in certain high streets. And there are cases where even if the landlord charges zero rent, then a store is not viable because of the business rates. So that is definitely a challenge. People don't like paying for parking. And I think that's one of the reasons why high street stores have struggled to a certain extent, and councils to some extent eroded their own tax base by charging for parking, but then losing out on business rates because people don't go there anymore. And that's, you know, another reason why people like the out of town retail parks. You know, there's much too much shopping in certain towns, and that will have to change, and you know, shops will have to be converted into other types of uses.
Heard lots about returns recently, which the consumer watchdog looking at returns and charging for returns. Have returns become too expensive a bit of the business? Is it something that you're looking at all?
I think returns are definitely part of running an online business, aren't they? And I think that we try and be as joined up and as omni-channel as we possibly can at Mountain Warehouse. You know, we encourage people to return products to stores if they want to, and most people do. But running distribution centers, however efficient you are, you know, is expensive. I think that's one of the reasons why having a bricks and clicks approach, shops and where you get great customer service from our colleagues and a seamless online presence is probably the right place to be right now, rather than being a pure play online business.
Mark Neal, the boss and founder of Mountain Warehouse, then.
Well, thank you very much indeed. 28 minutes past six. Good morning to Gary with the sport news.
Good morning to you. Another brilliant win for Britain's Jack Draper. It's taken him through to the semi-final of the US Tennis Open. He defeated Alex de Minaur 6-3, 7-5, 6-2. And Russell Fuller reports from New York.
Alex de Minaur was not 100% fit following a hip injury, which denied him the chance to play Novak Djokovic in the quarterfinals at Wimbledon. But Jack Draper was still able to complete a fifth straight sets victory of the fortnight. He lost his way briefly in the middle of the second set, but produced an explosive finish, underlying the power which makes him so dangerous. Draper did feel some discomfort in his right leg at the end of the first set. Strapping was required, and he later described a niggle, which did at least not get any worse.
Well, Jack Draper then, yet to drop a set, as Russell said. Here's his reaction to reaching the last four, and also playing on the famous Arthur Ashe court.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, obviously looking up, it feels like, you know, it's a huge arena. Been out there a few times myself. You know, it really is iconic. And to play out there was in itself something that I've wanted to do since I was a kid. And to obviously come through in a quarterfinal match, you know, that means the world to me. So obviously extremely proud and honoured to be able to play on Ash, and I'll get another opportunity to do it, I guess, on Friday.
Yes, on Friday he will play Jannik Sinner, who defeated Daniel Medvedev in four sets. Paralympics, British competitors won 13 medals on the latest day of competition. The team are second in the table behind China. And Sarah Storey won her 18th career gold. She's going to be a guest on the programme later. There's a busy few days coming up in football's Nations League. England take on Republic of Ireland on Saturday. And Angel Gomez is one of four uncapped players who's been added to the squad. Gomez now plays for the French side Lille, having made one brief appearance for Manchester United.
I think playing for your country, you can wait as long as it takes, really. That's the highest moment you can get to, personally. And I've seen everyone do it early, but it didn't discourage me, if anything. It made me hungrier, and whether it would have took me an extra 3 years, 4 years, or however long it takes, I'm just happy that I'm in the position that I'm in now, and I hope that it can continue for more years.
Scotland play Poland this evening at Hampden. There's commentary on 5 Live, while Northern Ireland take on Luxembourg. Great win for Jack Draper. Lots more later.
Extraordinary win, wasn't it? Exciting times.
Indeed, really exciting. Thanks very much, Gary.
Knowledge has transformed our understanding of the universe and ourselves. But I'm here to argue that ignorance is just as important.
Every new creative endeavour basically begins in ignorance.
A new series exploring the power of ignorance from art to science to politics.
Just to have in the back of your mind that whatever I believe may in fact be wrong, because that opens me up then to being receptive to other viewpoints.
The long history of ignorance from Confucius to QAnon, with me, Rory Stewart, on BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds.
Time now, 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson and Jane Steele, who has a summary of the news.
Water company bosses could lose their bonuses and be sent to jail under new legislation aimed at reducing pollution. It's hoped the laws will make it easier for regulators in England and Wales to impose fines. Critics say the problem is that existing laws haven't been enforced properly. Last year, there were more than 450,000 sewage spills in England. Water companies say they agree the system is not working. A housing minister has warned that not all buildings wrapped in the same type of dangerous cladding that covered Grenfell Tower have been identified. Yesterday's report on the disaster accused companies of deliberately concealing the fire risks posed by some of their building materials. Hundreds of high-rise buildings where flammable cladding has been found still haven't been made safe because of disputes over who should pay to remove it. British universities say they will slide into decline without action to sort out their finances. In a speech later today, the university's UK president, Dame Sally Mapstone, will call on the government to rethink how they're funded. Ministers say they're considering all options, but responsibility shouldn't fall entirely on the state. Police in the US state of Georgia say a 14-year-old boy will be charged with murder after four people were killed and nine injured in a school shooting in Georgia. Two pupils and two teachers died in yesterday's attack at Appalachee High School. The FBI said agents had interviewed the suspect last year for making online threats about a school shooting. A hospice in West Sussex has become the latest to announce job cuts, with staff being told that 35 posts will need to go. It's the sixth hospice in recent weeks to take such action because of financial pressures for those providing end-of-life care. The Department for Health says the government has inherited huge challenges. Indigenous Maori chiefs in New Zealand have sworn in a new queen. Ngāwe Hono Itipo was selected to succeed her father, King Tehetia, who died last week. He was laid to rest following an elaborate ceremony where elders crowned his 27-year-old daughter as the second Maori queen.
There you go. Jane, thank you very much. 27 minutes to seven. Incompetence, failure and deliberate concealment, some of the words and phrases used in the long-awaited final inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire disaster published yesterday, more than 7 years on since the worst residential fire since the Second World War that saw 72 people lose their lives. The inquiry found that firms involved in the disastrous refurbishment of the tower operated with systematic dishonesty, there was decades of failure by central government and all 72 deaths were avoidable. The Prime Minister said yesterday that the Grenfell report would be a moment of change for this country. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is here. Do we know some more detail about the government's response?
Well, Keir Starmer apologised on behalf of the British state yesterday. And, you know, I don't think anyone looking at the report, which said that successive governments had missed warnings from as early as 1992 that could have prevented this, you know, would think that that wasn't the reasonable and appropriate thing for him to do. But it also instantly makes clear that as far as this government is concerned, Grenfell is one of those great national scandals. You know, it's rare for a prime minister to apologise on behalf of the British state. You might think of David Cameron doing it after the Hillsborough inquiry or after the Bloody Sunday inquiry, or Rishi Sunak doing it in response to the Infected Blood inquiry. You know, these are rare moments, but they also do, I think, put an onus on the government to act. And when Keir Starmer spoke yesterday, he spoke both about the government digesting the vast report and coming back within 6 months with a formal response to all of its recommendations, but also about faster measures, especially on the remediation of cladding that is still up, still unsafe, in which hundreds of thousands of people are living.
And some may find it difficult still to believe, even if they know the technicalities of an inquiry happened first, that was a political choice, so that prosecutions had to wait, but they still might find it difficult to understand how no one has been in a dock, no one has been prosecuted. What do we know about that?
Well, the government said yesterday that it will support the authorities, the criminal authorities, with the criminal justice process. But, you know, Keir Starmer is a former director of public prosecutions. You know, he will, I think, appreciate the procedural reasons why it may still be, you know, it sounds like if anyone is ever going to be in the dock on trial as a result of this, that probably isn't even going to begin until something like 10 years, if not more, after the actual disaster back in 2017. I think politically for Keir Starmer, you know, to reassure the public that justice will be done for the Grenfell families, to some degree at least, you know, he will want to show that he can take some action while that criminal justice process is ongoing. So he said yesterday that the government would announce further steps this autumn in terms of remediation of cladding. He said the current pace is unacceptable, and it appears that that could well include criminal penalties for non-compliance to compel building owners to meet those obligations. He also announced some measures yesterday in terms of the companies, the organisations that were named in the report. He said that he had written to the companies as a first step to them losing government contracts. Still not clear what time frame that would be over, what other steps would be needed. But that, I think, also an attempt by the government to demonstrate that there will be consequences that they can impose while that criminal justice process is still ongoing.
Henry Zeffman, good to talk to you. Chief Political Correspondent, thank you.
23 minutes to seven now. Hundreds more people crammed into overpacked inflatables off the French coast yesterday, despite the horror the day before, which claimed 12 lives. We can talk now to our correspondent, Andrew Harding. It feels like it was just business as usual, Andrew.
Morning. Yes, striking, but perhaps not surprising, business as usual. The smugglers out cramming more and more people into these flimsy boats. The French authorities say, look, they are having some more success in actually intercepting boats and motors before they get anywhere close to the French beaches. So that, over the long term, might have an impact in reducing numbers. But right now, the unintended consequence is that the smugglers are, as we've seen, forcing more and more of their paying passengers into these individual boats, 50, 60, 70, 80 at a time. And that means that they are putting huge risks on those people. It was striking yesterday to talk to some French fishermen in Boulogne who'd just come back from another fishing trip. But on Tuesday, they told us how they had stumbled across the aftermath just minutes after that boat had capsized. And these young fishermen were talking of their grief and shock of being essentially obliged to pull the bodies of young women out of the water, dead bodies all. And one woman had a phone around her neck in a plastic bag that started ringing as one fisherman pulled her from the waters. So a real sense of gloom here, and a feeling that right now nothing is changing to improve the situation.
Tough times for those fishermen and everybody else involved in the rescue. We're going to be hearing your report a little later in the programme, Andrew, and talking indeed to Rob Laurie, the man behind that programme, To Catch a Scorpion, the BBC Sounds podcast, brilliant podcast about migration. Look forward to that. Thank you.
21 minutes to 7. Ukraine's western city of Lviv is still counting the cost of yesterday's wave of attacks, which killed 7 people, including a baby and 4 children. Nick Beek, our Europe correspondent, is here. Nick, it's been a quieter night in terms of drone attacks, but people are living in a permanent state of alert and very aware of warnings and sirens.
Good morning, Emma. Yes, they certainly are. Just looking at a map that people have on their app that they download here, there has been, it would seem, a relatively uneventful night. Some reports of drones over the capital, Kyiv, but certainly no repeat of what we saw in Lviv, as you say, 24 hours ago, so close to the Polish border, so close to where the NATO military alliance begins. But nonetheless, Russia struck that particular city with devastating effect. It said it was going for sites related to the Ukrainian defense industry. In reality, we saw schools, clinics, and homes hit. And as you were saying there, at least 7 people killed, including 4 members of the same family, a mum and her 3 daughters. All 3 daughters were killed. And there was this image, this harrowing image that people have been talking about over the past 24 hours of the dad, Yaroslav, the only survivor who was rescued by firefighters from the building, whereas the bodies of all his family were carried away in blankets.
Well, in terms of the response of Ukraine and how to manage that, politically there's been some change, hasn't there? Ukraine's foreign minister resigned yesterday ahead of a big reshuffle of the Ukrainian cabinet. Why are these movements politically happening at the moment?
Well, President Zelensky, I think, might say a bit more later on, but he's given some indications of why he's doing this. He's calling it a reset of his government, says new energy is needed, and that there needs to be a new direction in international policy, and that diplomacy is not an exception to all of these governmental departments. So, as you say, that is a reference to Dmytro Kuleba's departure, a career diplomat, the foreign minister. And for a lot of people, he's become a familiar face, really. We've seen him visit capitals all around the world, trying to gain diplomatic support for Ukraine, trying to win military assistance too. And he was the sort of suit and tie compliment to Mr. Zelensky's trademark military green that he wears all the time. We don't know where the foreign minister has gone. Unclear whether he's fallen out with Mr. Zelensky, or maybe he'll get an expanded job. But we are expecting more appointments today. Worth pointing out, Emma, that Mr. Zelensky, his own presidential term, his first term, was due to end about 3 months ago. But he's still president because of martial law that the country's under. Critics are saying that he's taking that opportunity basically to bring more of his loyalists into the government, consolidating power. Supporters, though, say he's putting Ukraine in the best possible position going into what will be another tough autumn and winter with ongoing Russian strikes, particularly on the energy infrastructure.
Fascinating to hear that side of things, and more later, as you say. Nick Beek, our Europe correspondent, thank you.
17 minutes to 7, let's take a look at the morning front pages, dominated by the Grenfell report. Many papers having on the front page the 72 photographs. Well, some were not identified of the victims, but all of the photographs that are available now. Get them justice is the headline in the Mirror. Underneath those photographs, killer failings is its headline inside the paper, listing all the people who are criticised in the report. Will they ever get justice? Ask the Daily Mail on its front page. the Sun headline, now put them in the dock. Quotes, as many papers do, the Metron Police's Deputy Assistant Commissioner Stuart Cundy, saying we have one chance to get our investigation right. We'll be thorough and diligent in our investigation while moving as swiftly as possible. But the papers, many of them pointed out, not that swiftly. We're talking of 2026 or 7 for charges to be brought.
And just inside the Times on the same story, a survivor of the fire, Marcio Gomes, talked about the emotion of the public inquiry, the final part of it, catching up with him, having heard Sir Martin Morbeck's final few words, where he soberly listed the names of the 72 people who died in the disaster, and among them Marcio's unborn son, Logan. And he also said only serious jail time will give us the justice that we need. Well, we'll be talking about what changes will be made with the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, but also for asking for her view on why and how those prosecutions may happen.
One story to cheer everybody up on the front page of the Telegraph. Cracker Jack is its headline, as Gary's been talking about Jack Draper, through to the semis of the US Open. Well, I think we're going to be hearing from his mum a bit later on. It's coming up to 6:45. Our main news this morning, water company executives could face up to 2 years in prison if they obstruct regulators under new anti-pollution powers being proposed by the government.
Now, the Prime Minister made a statement to MPs yesterday in Parliament following the publication of that Grenfell Tower report. But before that, he was in the Commons for Prime Minister's questions, and he faced more pressure over changes to winter fuel payments for pensioners. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Elisa McCarthy.
It was a sombre Sir Keir Starmer in dark grey suit and black tie who arrived at the Commons dispatch box for only his second PMQs as Prime Minister and his first since the summer recess. On the opposition benches, Rishi Sunak remains in place as Conservative leader for now, as the Tories slowly whittle down the candidates to replace him. Since the election, there's been heated argument between the two parties about the state of the public finances inherited by the new regime. Ultimately, Rishi Sunak observed, government was all about choices.
And the new Prime Minister has made a choice. He has chosen to take the winter fuel allowance away from low-income pensioners and give that money to certain unionised workforces in inflation-busting pay rises.
One of the early decisions by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, was to remove winter fuel payments worth up to £300 a year from all but the poorest pensioners in England and Wales. She also announced pay rises for nurses, teachers and junior doctors. And the government also later agreed a multi-year pay deal with train drivers to end long-running strikes. Keir Starmer reckoned they'd had no choice.
This government was elected to clear up the mess left by the party opposite and to bring about the change that the country desperately needs. Our first job was to audit the books. And what we found was a £22 billion black hole.
Rishi Sunak replied that what Labour had actually inherited was low inflation, low unemployment and economic growth. But he said Keir Starmer had to take responsibility for the decisions he'd made since getting into number 10. And it was his decision
to award a train driver on £65,000 a pay rise of almost £10,000. And it was also his decision that a pensioner living on just £13,000 will have their winter fuel allowance removed.
Keir Starmer defended the decision, arguing it wasn't possible to fix the economy if the trains didn't run or the NHS didn't work.
No Prime Minister wants to do what we have to do in relation to the winter fuel allowance, but we have to take the tough decision to stabilise our economy to ensure that we can grow it for the future.
The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, shared the case of one couple who'd be hit by the change. He said for 18 years, Norman had been a full-time carer for his wife, Roz. Because their income was just above the limit, they were set to lose their winter fuel allowance.
What advice does the Prime Minister have to Norman and Roz and millions of struggling pensioners as they face rising heating bills this winter?
Keir Starmer insisted the choices being made were because of the black hole in funding Rachel Reeves had found, and his government couldn't pretend it didn't exist. When Prime Minister's questions came to an end, Keir Starmer stayed at the dispatch box to make a statement on the findings of the Grenfell Tower report. It concluded that the disaster in which 72 people lost their lives 7 years ago was the result of decades of failure. Looking up to some of the families in the public gallery, Keir Starmer apologised on behalf of the state.
It should never have happened. The country failed to discharge its most fundamental duty to protect you and your loved ones, the people that we are here to serve, and I am deeply sorry.
Keir Starmer said he'd visited Grenfell Tower 2 weeks ago. Walking down the blackened stairs from the 23rd floor, he'd got a sense of the terror and anger of those affected, and he made this promise.
In the memory of your loved ones, we will deliver a generational shift in the safety and quality of housing for everyone in this country.
Rishi Sunak said the report by Sir Martin Moore-Bick was a damning indictment of 30 years of state failure.
Sir Martin Moore-Bick and the work of the inquiry have painted a picture of systemic indifference, failure, and in some notable cases, dishonesty and greed.
And he too apologised to the victims and families.
The state let you down, and it must never do so again.
The longest continuously serving female MP, the mother of the House, Labour's Diane Abbott, represents a London constituency. She said the majority of those who died in the 2017 fire were among the most marginalised. She wanted a promise their families would be supported and an assurance
that it will not take 7 years to bring those responsible to justice.
The Prime Minister said another 7 years couldn't be allowed to pass before what he called the necessary action was taken.
That was Alicia McCarthy reporting, and you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on BBC Sounds. Now at 7:10, sliding into decline. That is the phrase used by the head of Universities UK to describe what's happening to our seats of learning. She wants fees to rise. Yesterday, the Education Minister, Jackie Smith, told a conference of university leaders they might in future need to rely less on the state for their funding. She was answering a question from Professor David Maguire, Vice-Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, who joins us on the line now. Good morning to you, Professor Maguire. What do you make of her answer?
Good morning, Nick. Well, obviously, quite disappointed. Universities are under significant financial pressure at the present time. That's a consequence of the intense competition brought upon by the lifting of the student number cap in 15-16. We've had costs rising like everybody else, and our principal income source is fixed. And on top of that, particularly for this cycle, we've had a collapse in the international student recruitment numbers coming in to study in postgraduate courses.
When you talk about collapse, what does it mean at UEA? How big a collapse?
Well, we're looking at about 50% reduction in our international student postgraduate numbers. Our home numbers are pretty good, but that leaves a very significant need to close a gap in our business plan in order to continue to run the full rate of services that we do. This is not a UEA-specific thing. This is systemic right across the whole sector.
So the question then is what you do, isn't it, Professor Maguire? Now, clearly, there might be an increase in tuition fees, but if it comes at all, it's unlikely to be big, isn't it? The government might change the policy on international students, unlikely, given the pressure under immigration. You're either going to have to cut or you're going to have to raise money in a new way, aren't you?
Well, that's right. And all university vice chancellors that I talk to are looking very carefully at their income expenditure lines and are looking for efficiencies. This is not a one-off thing. This has been going for multiple years. So we're looking at increasing class sizes. We're conducting less research. We're re-evaluating practice-based teaching. We're looking at student support levels. In the light of the fact that mental health is rising, we're reluctant to, is getting worse. We're reluctant to do that, of course. And then there's going to be a loss of personalisation. Mm. So I'm really calling upon the Secretary of State to evaluate really carefully two things. One is the cap on student maintenance and loans and grants, and the undergraduate student fee cap to at least, as a minimum, increase that with inflation.
She is saying to you, you may need to look elsewhere. Is there an external source of funding? Because as you will know, many institutions in the United States, for example, get much more of their money from other sources.
Yes, and all universities have a multitude of different income streams, including philanthropy, including commercial exploitation of their research and intellectual property, and a number raise income through conferences and other activities. And we're all doing that. And of course, we're all looking at how we can increase that at the present time. But proportionately, that's quite small compared to the principal income source, which is student tuition fees, with one or two notable exceptions, things like Oxford University Press and Warwick Manufacturing Group, which make a very distinctive contribution to their universities.
So the pressure is on the government to come up with an answer. Professor McGuire, Vice-Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, thanks for joining us.
7 minutes to seven. This is really exciting and interesting. There are efforts to establish a library dedicated to George Orwell on the remote Scottish Isle of Jura, which has a population of just over 200 and was the writer's home towards the end of his life while he wrote the novel 1984. Long a place of pilgrimage for fans of his work. Earlier this year, to mark the 75th anniversary of that seminal novel being published, an artist collected 1,984 copies of 1984 together and now wants to give this mobile library a permanent home. That artist, Hans K. Clausen, who's based in Edinburgh, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
I love that you collected all of these copies of 1984. What inspired you? How hard was it to do?
It was inspired initially by discovering I had six copies of this book in my studio and was curious as to why I'd collected them, and reread the book, recognised its relevance, its importance to me and its relevance to the time that we're in. And I started thinking I want to make some kind of artistic response. With the 75th anniversary coming up, I wanted to do something to respond to that. And that became the idea of building a touring library, which would have only one novel in it, but it'd have the 1,984 different copies of it. So that began, it went from six copies to 100 copies. And before I knew it, I was heading for the total for this June. Yeah.
Are they all different? The covers, they can't be, can they?
They're not different editions. They're just unique copies.
We
have quite a few copies that are the same, but because they're patina, the way that they've been treated and stored and read, they all have their own little unique anecdotes written in them, or the bus ticket bookmark, or all these kind of things, all the kind of stories that they bring with them.
I love that. And for the more permanent, exhibition or library rather, yeah. Tell us where that's up to.
We got it all into a Luton van and drove from Edinburgh to Jura for the 8th of June. We had it set up and displayed in the Jura Village Hall for 3 days over that weekend. We had over 350 people came in to see it, which isn't bad for an island with about 200 residents. We kind of launched it. That was it. The idea being that we took this novel back home to the island where it was written, and now we want to take the library across the UK, possibly even further. It's going to be an interactive library. We want to take it to organisations, to institutions, to places of learning, get people to engage with it. And then after a year or two of touring, I'd love to take it back and give it its permanent home in Jura and make it a place of destination there.
I also just love the idea of people making that pilgrimage to Jura.
Yeah, and we've got lots of stories that have come with books. I have a couple of books from the States where people have heard about the project. One guy drove 150 miles to his storage unit and spent a day trying to find his original copy.
Of course he did.
Dug it out, sent it to Scotland with a little letter, and it sits on the shelves. So that idea, people really are kind of connected to this novel. It's one of the reasons that I chose it.
I'm now thinking, where's my university copy? I will see what I can do. Hans K. Clausen, lovely to talk to you. All the best with it.
But if somebody borrows one, do you have to then go and buy another one?
You can't lend people books, though, can you? That's the rule.
No, tricky. Now, 3 minutes to seven, time for the weather. Here's Helen.
And it's a very complicated book of weather today, I've got to say. We've got so many different things going on. So first of all, across the south of England, South Wales, it's going to be predominantly cloudy, and we've got outbreaks of rain, and now there are thunderstorms embedded in that at the moment across the channel, and that's all heading its way northwards. So there's a potential for some really quite heavy falls of rain across this part of the world during the day today. 21 if the sun comes out, but around 18 or 19 for the most part. So wet. Now, further north, across central and northern Wales, into the Midlands, across parts of East Anglia and northern England, less likely to see heavy rain today. But there's quite a bit of cloud around, and it's giving some rather misty conditions, particularly near the North Sea coast. It's thick enough for some drizzle across much of northern England, particularly the Pennines. So the best of any brighter, sunnier weather will be across the west of Wales, northwest Wales and the northwest of England. So here, perhaps 20. 14 are high on the east coast. Finally, across Scotland and Northern Ireland, a good deal of dry weather today, plentiful sunshine, particularly Northern Ireland and the western half of Scotland, where temperatures will again get up to 17, 18 degrees Celsius. But across central and eastern parts of Scotland, more cloud coming in off the North Sea. Mostly dry, but perhaps the odd spot of rain and drizzle. And for many, there's quite a brisk east-northeasterly wind today, which will just temper the feel of things a little.
Thanks very much for that. There you go. Next Wednesday.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and as America prepares for another presidential election, we've got a new series of The Coming Storm. We're investigating how a vast conspiracy movement has gripped the United States.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
We demand the truth.
In this world, hidden hands control events, and nothing is as it seems.
You believe that US intelligence was involved in this cover-up somehow?
I do. And I'm not quite sure why.
The Coming Storm, starting next Wednesday morning at 9:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Coming up, the chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Court defends his decision to seek the arrest of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. How to improve the postal service? Well, we'll be hearing from the regulator in a few minutes' time. And after 32 years, she's done it again. One gold. Sarah Story will be with us.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Emma Barnett. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 5th of September. It's good to be with you and have your company today. Let me tell you the headlines. Water company bosses could be jailed and lose their bonuses under proposed new powers for regulators to stamp out sewage spills. Ministers have warned there may be more buildings not yet identified wrapped in flammable cladding. And universities say they face a slide into decline without action to address financial pressures. The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Water company executives could be banned from receiving bonuses and sent to jail under new government legislation aimed at reducing pollution. The bill, which will apply in England and Wales, gives regulators more powers and makes it easier for them to impose penalties. Last year, there were more than 450,000 sewage spills in England. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
This legislation makes it easier for the Environment Agency to take enforcement action and introduces tougher penalties for executives. If they obstruct an investigation, they could now face up to 2 years in jail. Bonuses for bosses will only be allowed if their companies are judged by the regulator to have met both environmental and financial standards. The Environment Secretary Steve Reed said the new laws should end what he called the disgraceful behaviour of water companies and their bosses. Critics say that up till now, the problem hasn't been the laws, but the willingness and ability of the industry regulators to enforce them. In response, the water companies said they agreed the current system was not working. They're calling on the regulators to back their £105 billion investment plan for new infrastructure. If approved, it will be paid for through higher customer bills.
Ministers have warned that not all buildings wrapped in dangerous cladding, like the type which caught fire at Grenfell Tower, have been identified. Yesterday's report on the disaster accused companies of being dishonest and deliberately concealing the fire risks posed by their construction materials. Hundreds of high-rise buildings where flammable cladding has been found still haven't been made safe because of disputes over who should pay for the remedial work. Chichi Uzundu reports.
Failure, incompetence and deliberate concealment are some of the words used by the inquiry in its excoriating condemnation of the companies, regulators and governments involved. The 1,700-page document found that fire tests had proven how dangerous the cladding was, but that was kept secret. The government had been warned about it 25 years ago, but the combustible cladding wasn't banned. The inquiry also found systemic dishonesty by the cladding companies and indifference from the local council. Last night, Matthew Pennycook, the housing minister, said the government would bring forward in the autumn a strategy to deal with the hundreds of buildings that still have unsafe cladding.
We've got to review how leaseholders are better protected from costs. We've got to accelerate the pace of remediation. But looking under the bonnet, we found a number of challenges. For example, we don't know for certain that all of the buildings that are dangerous have been identified. So we've got to do more work in that area.
72 people lost their lives because of the Grenfell Tower fire. Survivors and bereaved families have called for the police investigation to be accelerated after prosecutors said it would take until the end of 2026 for a final decision to be made on criminal charges.
The head of the organisation that represents universities is warning they face a slide into decline unless the government takes action to ease pressure on funding. Dame Sally Mapston from Universities UK will tell a conference of vice-chancellors that the sector is at a fork in the road. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
University finances are under pressure. There's been a sharp fall in applications from international students since visa restrictions came into force in January. That's piled on pressure in England, where tuition fees have increased by £250 in the last 12 years, falling far behind inflation. At least 40% of universities are forecasting a deficit in their budgets. In a speech this morning, Professor Dame Sally Mapstone from Universities UK is expected to warn without decisions on funding, institutions face a slide into decline. The Higher Education Minister, Jackie Smith, said the government was looking at all options for England, including how to address the cost of living pressures on students.
Police in the US state of Georgia say a 14-year-old boy will be charged with murder after two pupils and two teachers were shot dead at a high school. The suspect surrendered to officers at Appalachee High School in Winder. The FBI said agents had interviewed the boy and his father last year for making online threats about a school shooting. This boy was in the classroom where the shooting started.
I got up, I started running, he started shooting like 10 times, he shot at least 10 times. And then I ran to the back of the classroom, I dived behind the desk, and my teacher had got in front of me, like he was guarding. But like the gunshots were so close to me, like my ears started ringing real bad.
US officials have imposed sanctions on two of the most senior editors of the Russian state-funded broadcaster RT, accusing them of participating in a Kremlin-backed operation to interfere with November's presidential election. Eight other people have been sanctioned, and the US Justice Department has seized more than 30 online domains which were allegedly used to spread disinformation. Our correspondent Jenny Kumar reports from Washington.
Multiple US government agencies have announced measures aimed at curbing the alleged spread of Russian-backed disinformation and attempts to influence November's elections, including visa restrictions, sanctions and indictments. The US Treasury Department accused RT's editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonyan, and her deputy of spending $10 million to secretly pay an unnamed company in Tennessee to spread thousands of videos on social media. The US Attorney General, Merrick Garland, said Moscow's goal was to secure its preferred outcome in the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. The National Security Council spokesman, John Kirby, said he believed President Putin was aware of the alleged actions by the Russian state broadcaster. But in a statement to the BBC, RT dismissed the claims.
The British barrister, who's the chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, has told the BBC that justice must seem to be done after he sought an arrest warrant for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defence minister Yoav Gallant. Karim Khan said it was important to show that the court would hold all nations to the same standard in relation to alleged war crimes. He also requested warrants for the three leaders of Hamas. Judges at the ICC are expected to decide whether to take the warrants forward in the coming days. Mr. Khan has been speaking to Nick Robinson for his Political Thinking podcast.
I think what we're doing is the antithesis of politics. It's about the equal application of the law, irrespective of whether one receives a round of applause from some quarters or a deafening din of condemnation and assaults of different types from another. The law should be blind to power, to wealth. What we have to do is try to apply the law in a way that is equal based upon some common standards. And that's the job of the International Criminal Court.
A 14-year-old boy is due to appear in a youth court in Leicester this morning, charged with the murder of an 80-year-old man in a park near the city. Bim Coley died on Monday after being attacked while walking his dog. A hospice in West Sussex has become the latest to announce job cuts, telling staff that more than 40 posts need to go and £1.5 million needs to be saved. Last week, BBC News revealed that five hospices in England were facing cuts in what's been called a financial crisis for those providing end-of-life care. Our health editor Hugh Pym has the details.
Managers at St Catherine's Hospice in West Sussex said funding of the sector needed an urgent root and branch review. They added that the government contribution now covered 23% of running costs and that over 10 years it had not kept up with inflation. Cost of living increases, they said, had affected donors' ability to give. Inpatient bed numbers at the hospice will not at this stage be reduced. Hospice UK, representing the sector, said no other area of the health system would tolerate service cuts and redundancies on this scale and warned that further announcements by other charities were likely. The Department of Health said the government had inherited huge challenges, but ministers were determined to shift more health care out of hospitals into the community.
Hugh Pym reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 9 minutes past seven. Water executives will no longer be able to line their pockets whilst pumping filth into rivers and the sea. That, at least, is the promise being made by the new Environment Secretary today as he sets out plans for new legislation which will allow the water regulator Ofwat to block bonuses and to impose tougher penalties, fines and ultimately imprisonment on water executives who fail to cooperate or obstruct investigations. The move comes as the water companies themselves complain that what they need is higher price rises to raise the money needed to invest in cleaning up our waterways. We're joined now by the chair and founder of the campaigning organisation River Action, critic of the water companies and the regulator, Charles Watson. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
What do you make of these steps? Will it make a difference?
Well, look, first of all, I'd like to say, finally, after years of denial over the whole scandal of the pollution of our rivers, lakes and seas, we've got a government of the day acknowledging the scale of the problem and in particular acknowledging the abject failure of the regulators who've allowed all this to happen on their watch. But sadly, what we've got today is basically it's a long list of measures that will cost the government nothing, but they're not really going to fix anything because it's the system that's broken. These are sort of touching around the edges. They're treating some of the symptoms of the scandal, but they don't get to the cause of the problem.
Now, why so? When you say won't fix anything, people listening might think, well, look, new fines for water executives, the threat of prison, won't that concentrate their minds?
Well, I think you need to read the small print. Regard the threat of prison, it's threatening to send them to prison if they obstruct an investigation into law-breaking. So, I mean, that's pretty random. I don't think anyone will be going to prison. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the sight of, the CEO of Severn Trent, walking off with a pay package of 3.2 million after the company has just illegally discharged 260 million litres of sewage into the River Trent. I mean, obviously, the bonuses these people have been receiving has been outrageous. But the problem is we are dealing with a broken system. We don't really need any new laws. We have all the laws. We have all the regulations. They've just never been enforced. The bodies that were charged to do this, Ofwat in terms of regulating the water industry and the Environment Agency, have basically allowed the country to get into a situation where last year 3.6 million hours of raw sewage were discharged into our waterways. Only 14% of the rivers in this country are in good ecological condition. These are nice headline grabbing things that I'm sure they tested very well in the focus groups in the run up to the election. But I repeat, they do not fix the problem.
Skepticism. What I'm unclear about, though, is that what could happen to make Ofwat the regulator, to make the Environment Agency enforce the rules in the way that you obviously feel passionately they should and could?
Well, I mean, the key in this announcement, you'll find it further down the page, the government are pledging to introduce further legislation, I quote, to clean up our waterways for good. So they obviously acknowledge that this is not anywhere near getting to the root of the problem. So we want to know what that legislation is. What we need to hear that there is a comprehensive, holistic plan that looks at all the other, not just sewage, but all the other causes of pollution, such as agriculture and road runoff, which has ambitious targets, which is properly funded, because none of these measures today are going to cost the government a penny. And most importantly, this legislation has to be brought forward with real urgency.
Last one then to you, Mr. Watson. You mentioned about the cost. What the water companies are saying is, look, when you have a go at us over profits, you're out of date. That's what happened in the past. Now we simply don't have the money we need from investors to improve a Victorian system. And you've got to let us put the prices up instead of bashing us all the time.
Well, look, last year, this is an industry that distributed to shareholders £1.4 billion billion, 1.4 billion in dividends. And in terms of the fines it was subjected to, they equated to 1% of that. So basically, this is an industry that can still distribute huge amounts of largesse to its shareholders. And the water companies, they're talking as if they're the victims here. They're complaining that the customers have to foot the bill. And I mean, customer bills are going to have to go up. There's no question about that. But what are they offering? Are they saying, well, we're going to suspend dividends for 2 or 3 years? We're going to do our bit if we want customers to divvy up and pay their contribution. Why aren't the water companies offering to hand back some of the money they're paying out to their shareholders?
A question for them on another day. Charles Watson, thank you very much indeed, organiser there of River Action Campaigning.
14 minutes past seven, excuse me, and freshly delivered to the studio in terms of, let's talk about post, because how should the UK's universal postal service evolve and modernise? People still hugely rely on it, but Royal Mail service is not as good as it could be, despite the letter volume having halved since 2011. Ofcom fined Royal Mail for poor performance. That's, of course, the communications watchdog. £5.6 million that fine last year for failing to meet its first and second class delivery target. And Ofcom's just published an update of its review of the Universal Post Service and is suggesting, here's the new bit, that Royal Mail no longer delivers second class post on Saturdays. First class deliveries would remain a 6 day a week service. As I say, freshly delivered to our studio, Lindsay Fussell, Ofcom Group Director for Networks and Communications. Good morning.
Good morning.
Have I got that right? That's the new bit?
That's right. I mean, what we're saying today is that the universal service does need to change. It's changed a lot in its 500-year history, but now it's time to change again because the way that we use postal services is changing. And to be clear, no change is not really an option. Otherwise, it is going to become unsustainable and we're all going to have to pay a lot more for it. So earlier in the year, we called for a national debate. We've heard from a lot of people. And the option we're now going to be exploring is focused on second class and the potential to drop that down to 5 days a week with no Saturday deliveries.
Why not to fewer days than that? Why not to for 3 days, for instance?
Well, as I say, we've heard from an awful lot of people. And what people have told us is, firstly, that first class services are really important to them. They do want a next day service 6 days a week for the occasional urgent item. But most items aren't urgent. They can wait that bit longer. They are more prepared to think about changes to second class. Royal Mail has also for the first time come forward with its own proposal to drop Saturday deliveries. And so what we're going to be doing now is really testing whether this option meets consumer needs, doing a lot of research before we come forward with formal proposals for regulatory change early next year.
So it's a sort of interim moment with where you're up to on this. I mean, is that enough, do you think, to save Royal Mail's universal postal service, which is under pressure without raising costs? Do you think it is?
Well, obviously, that's something we're going to be looking at very carefully. We want to make sure we've got a universal postal service that can last us for several decades to come. But what it's important to realise is that what can seem like quite a small change could actually mean that Royal Mail are able to make some pretty significant operational changes behind the scenes and save and make efficiencies and save money. But to be clear, this isn't a free pass for Royal Mail. This is, it will be to them to meet the challenge, to make those efficiencies, to reinvest in their network and to make it much more reliable for customers.
How many sort of people do you get involved when you invite a national debate on post?
Well, an awful lot. Post is something that we really care about in the
that.
UK.
I really know that. And people, you know, we've had on this programme extraordinary stories of people's Christmas cards not getting there till, you know, much later in the year. But what sort of engagement, what level?
So we had around 2,500 responses to our call for a debate earlier in the year. We also held events throughout the UK and we had hundreds of people come to talk to us from all sorts of places about what they thought.
Did you rely on Royal Mail for those people to get in touch?
Absolutely not. No, we arranged those events. We arranged those events ourselves.
No, I meant when the 2,500 people got in touch. Was that digital?
Well, I guess that's the point, isn't it? You know, 10 years ago, we we were sending 14 billion letters a year. Now it's 7 billion. And that's because we're all using digital services to communicate so much more.
It was just quite an interesting moment, I suppose, to think about how you use the post. When will we know what the actual changes will be? When will the conclusion be of this?
We'll consult on them early next year. And we hope that we'll be able to make a decision before the summer. We do think that change has to happen to make sure that we can keep a universal postal service
all in the
for decades to come.
Lindsay Fussell of Ofcom, thank you.
Thank you.
If you didn't make that consultation, the invitation was lost in the post, unfortunately. It's 18 minutes past seven. A new international agreement designed to reduce the risk posed by AI, artificial intelligence, will be signed by the Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, today. It'll be the world's first legally binding agreement in AI, and it comes from the Council of Europe. Having a look at what that means is our technology editor, Zoe Clymer. Morning to you, Zoe. What does it say, this new treaty?
Hi, Nick. So it's an international agreement on the priorities of AI legislation. And there's lots of different countries involved in this. There are 46 members of the Council of Europe alone. And they've also brought in 11 other countries as well, including quite big territories like the US and Japan. Now, to be honest with you, the actual content of it, if you follow AI regulation conversations quite closely, like I do, isn't really anything that you haven't heard before. It's designed to protect human rights and democracy from AI risks. It's designed to protect the public from the misuse of AI tools. It names issues like the spread of disinformation and the use of biased data as problems that it wants to safeguard against. And it commits the countries that have signed up to monitor AI developments and products. What's missing from it is any kind of enforcement mechanism. There's no carrot or stick to keep AI companies in line. But that's deliberate, Nick, because the onus is now going to be on the signatories to come up with their own legislation. And here's the thing. As we know, a lot of them are actually doing that already. And in the case of the EU, they've done it. We've got the EU AI Act. So while this is symbolic, I don't think you're going to suddenly see what we're really waiting for in this AI regulation journey that we're on, which is, you know, clear rules and clear consequences. That's not going to happen quite yet.
Well, my mistake, is not a treaty, crucially, is it? It's an agreement, in other words, about how they will produce their own laws and their own regulations. So it's a bit of a baby step by the sounds of it, so.
Well, it is symbolic, I think it is fair to say. And it is this idea that, you know, we need to have international oversight. There have been calls for a body like the UN or NATO to oversee AI because it's such an international issue that affects all of us. Here in the UK, we were expecting to see an AI bill get a mention in the Queen's speech back in July. Well, we didn't get that, but there's certainly a lot of activity in that direction going on. And we've heard from people like Lord Chris Holmes, who's developed a private members bill to legislate AI. So I suspect we're going to see a lot more conversation going on here in the UK as well. But certainly in terms of action, we're not there yet.
Zoe Clymer, thanks for joining us.
It's 20 past seven. The world's leading insurance market, Lloyd's of London, has announced bumper profits this morning, despite a significant hit to insurers following the Baltimore Bridge collapse. Will has more. Hi, Will.
Hi, Emma. Yeah, that's right. Lloyd's of London just reported its results for the first half of the year. Overall pre-tax profits, £4.9 billion, up from £3.9 billion in the same period last year. John Neal is the CEO of Lloyd's of London. John, morning.
Morning.
Bad weather events, terrible weather events, hurricanes, and the bridge collapse itself, and yet still strong performance and plenty of profits here in the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, we're growing, which is good news. We're profitable. I think the results are sustainable from an investor's point of view. And to the last point you were making, I think in a riskier world, we are also standing up for customers, whether it's climate-related activity or whether it's systemic exposures or, you know, the financial dynamics of the world at the moment or geopolitical uncertainty. You know, it's one of those unusual times when, as insurers, we have a responsibility to lean in to businesses, to individuals, and provide the support that we genuinely can.
Well, our business is taking some of those risks seriously enough. Maybe take climate change, but also cybersecurity. I mean, we've had the CrowdStrike event, haven't we, as well, that probably doesn't factor into some of your members' numbers.
It's a great question. I mean, the answer is yes and no. I mean, we're seeing insurance grow at twice the rate of GDP. I mean, I've never seen that in my 40 years in the industry. So I think there is an understanding that in a riskier world, some of that risk is better transferred to the balance sheet of an insurer. So the answer is partially yes. But when you look at some of the more complex insurances, such as cyber, which is growing, it should grow more. And I genuinely think we've got a job to do as insurers to explain better the value proposition of buying that type of insurance and why it is worth buying the insurance in the first place.
More broadly, you've been talking about, the investment environment here in the UK. You were speaking to the FT this morning with your concerns about the tax regime or the potential changes to the tax regime in the budget.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I think, you know, the financial climate is difficult. It's difficult for any government. I think it's, you know, we are pleased to see the government getting on the front foot and wanting to make change. But at the same time, we want to make sure that our credentials as a financial services market remain valid. So keeping the tax environment stable, both on a personal level and a corporate level, and ensuring from a regulatory point of view that we balance the need to regulate well with a competitive lens on what makes it attractive to do business here, is just so important.
John Neal, the Chief Executive of Lloyds of London, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. Sorry to interrupt that. We were talking, Emma and I, a little bit earlier about neither of us managed Oasis tickets. I think you did, didn't you?
I was definitely dynamically priced, though. I think they euphemistically called it a memorabilia ticket, and I did have a Liam Gallagher-esque reaction to the price when I spied it there.
But there is a serious business angle, isn't there? Because the regulator said they're looking at all this. We're going to, I think, hope to pursue that later in the programme.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the Competition and Markets Authority saying that they think that there needs to be more protections for consumers. This is, I think, around things like clarity, certainly in the early things that they've been talking about that price changing. You know, if you've queued for 6.5, 7 hours, as some of us might have done, and you get there, you potentially feel under a bit of pressure to make a choice that you may not have made if you'd known that going into it as well. So that's the type of thing I think that the CMA is going to be looking at, and obviously a spokesperson for the Prime Minister saying they want the regulators to look at it too. So plenty of political pressure around it as well.
Well, thanks for that. Yes, you could sit there for hours thinking you were buying a roughly £100 ticket and MD being offered a £300 ticket.
Definitely, maybe. 24 minutes past seven. Let's get the latest on the sport with Gary, who's just joined us.
I never had a problem when I used to go online and buy Nat King Cole and Bing Crosby tickets.
What, did they ask you for 2 shillings?
Yeah. They did. A very good morning to you. Jack Draper, what a star at the US Tennis Open.
He serves down the centre onto the backhand and paddles his backhand cross court for a clean winner! Draper raises his arms in victory. 7-5, 6-2. He's into a Grand Slam semi-final.
What a performance, Jack Draper beating Alex de Minaur. 6-3, 7-5, 6-2. Correspondent Russell Fuller was watching in New York. Russell, morning. Give us your assessment on this latest win.
Another very good win indeed. That is 5 straight sets wins in a row. It took him only just over 2 hours. Alex de Minaur was compromised, though. The hip injury, which forced him to pull out before he even took to the court in his quarterfinal against Novak Djokovic at Wimbledon, is still not quite right. And it wasn't the usual explosive movement we see from the Australian. But Draper still played very, very well. There was a little bit of a wobble in the middle of the second set, but he closed out the match with some explosive tennis of his own, using that big serve, some heavy hitting. Only real concern, Gary, the fact that at the end of the first set, he felt a little twinge in his right leg and put some tight strapping on it. He did say, though, afterwards that he felt that it was only a niggle and that it hadn't got worse as the match went on. So he's a Grand Slam semi-finalist at the age of 22, and he's been explaining how the route to the top has not always been a smooth one.
You know, I've had injuries, I've had setbacks, I've had times when, you know, I've maybe thought to stop or, you know, yeah, am I cut out for this sport? Am I good enough and all these sort of stuff? And you know, I kept on believing in myself, kept on working, and those are hard moments. You know, this is kind of not a hard moment compared to that. This is a privilege, and I'm not afraid of being in these positions. You know, I want to keep on doing this.
And he'll continue against Jannik Sinner, who defeated Daniel Medvedev in 4 sets. What are you expecting next?
I'm expecting Jack Draper to have to play very, very well to beat Jannik Sinner. He may not be at the peak of his powers, but he's doing a very passable impression of the world number one. And Draper is going to have to serve exceptionally well. He's going to have to use that power that I was talking about. He's just going to have to play an outstanding match if he's going to push the world number one, who won the title in Cincinnati just before the US Open. They've actually become pretty decent friends, these two, and actually played doubles in Montreal. But that obviously will take a back seat when they play in the semi-final in the Arthur Ashe Stadium on Friday.
Russell Fuller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary.
Football in the Nations League. Scotland play Poland this evening. There's commentary on 5 Live from 7.45. And Northern Ireland take on Luxembourg. Paralympics. British competitors won 13 medals on the latest day of competition in Paris. And Sarah Story won her 18th career gold. And she'll be a guest on the programme in about 20 minutes. And Jack Draper's mum will be my guest at 8.25. What a result.
She must be getting a bit nervous now.
We are going to find out. Will she be going? I'll ask her.
Yeah, looking forward to that, Gary. It's a very, very exciting run that he's on, isn't it?
Drift away with the sleeping forecast. A gentle mix of ambient music and the restful sounds of Radio 4's shipping forecast.
Fourth time. Lager, Fisher, German Bite, Humber, south or southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The Sleeping Forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now wake up.
That's,
now, Evan.
That's very dangerous to play people who present this programme, isn't it? Because of what time we don't go to sleep or
is
wake up.
A gentle sound of snoring. Oh,
just took a breath there. Right, let's have a look at the weather and pep ourselves up. Because today, heavy rain in the southwest, sunny in the northwest, and dry but cloudy elsewhere.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
Water company bosses will be held to account for sewage spills with bans on bonuses and prison terms under new government legislation. The proposed laws will apply in England and Wales and give increased powers to regulators to tackle polluting companies and make it easier for them to be fined. Critics say the regulators aren't making enough use of the powers they already have. A housing minister has warned there may still be buildings yet to be identified with the same type of dangerous cladding that covered Grenfell Tower. Yesterday, in a landmark report following an inquiry into the tragedy, multiple companies were accused of deliberately concealing how flammable some of their construction materials were. Disputes over who should pay for remedial work has meant hundreds of high-rise buildings with dangerous cladding have yet to be made safe. Saturday deliveries for second-class post could be scrapped as part of proposals by the regulator to reform the postal service. Ofcom, which has been investigating failures by Royal Mail to reach its delivery targets, is putting out to consultation the idea of slimmed-down second-class service while maintaining deliveries of first-class post 6 days a week. The head of the organisation that represents universities is warning they face a slide into decline unless the government takes action to ease pressure on funding. Students have been warned they may see cuts to staffing and courses as universities struggle with lower-than-inflation rises in tuition fees and fewer international students to make up the shortfall. Ministers say they're looking at all options. The US has imposed sanctions on the two most senior editors of the Russian state-funded broadcaster RT, accusing them of participating in a Kremlin-backed operation to interfere in November's presidential election. RT's editor-in-chief and deputy have been accused of recruiting social media influences to sway US public opinion. The Justice Department has seized 32 internet domains they say spread disinformation.
Jane, thank you. It's 7:30. Incompetence, failure and deliberate concealment, some of the words and phrases used in the long-awaited and damning final inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire disaster published yesterday. The inquiry found that firms involved in the disastrous refurbishment of the tower operated with systematic dishonesty, there was decades of failure by central government, and that all 72 deaths were avoidable. The Prime Minister yesterday apologised on behalf of the government, on behalf of the state, and said that the Grenfell report would be a moment of change. But what changes will we see in the treatment of tenants and how architects work and building regulation is understood or even rewritten, perhaps? Richard Blakeway, the Housing Ombudsman, joins us now, as does Jack Pringle, Chair of the Royal Institute of British Architects Board of Trustees and a former president, former REBA president. Richard, if I come to you first, good morning.
Good morning.
You are in charge of improving residents' lives, their relationships with landlords, and the relationship between the residents of Grenfell and their landlord and those tasked with this, it was pretty dire.
Oh, it's toxic. And there was a gross imbalance of power. And I think one of the things which is very striking from the report is the way in which the panel said that the landlord should not have allowed that situation, that poor relationship, to have grown to the extent that it did, to deteriorate to the extent that it did. Now, I have to say, every day in my casework, I will see landlords who I can't emphasize enough how caring, responsible, how strong their relationships can be with residents, even where things have gone wrong. But I also see the other side,
yes,
which is where, you know, some of the culture, the behaviors, the way in which complaints can be dismissed and devalued comes across incredibly strongly. And I can see all of those ingredients elsewhere in my casework.
And what can be done in light of this, seeing this laid out in this way and such a toxic relationship? Because those tenants tried.
Yes, they absolutely tried. And I think it starts with leadership, and it starts with a sense of openness and a willingness to recognise where things have gone wrong rather than be defensive, deflective and trying to manage reputation. I think one of the things which comes across in my casework very strongly is how systems and processes can be kind of callous and uncaring. And that's not necessarily the people who are operating them who are callous and uncaring, but the systems are. And you can see how the system pressures and budgetary pressures are kind of normalising behaviours, which when you step back, you say, well, that is absolutely unacceptable. And that is creating a kind of second-class citizen attitude towards social tenants.
Which, so we're talking about social tenants.
I think, well, in my casework, it will be social tenants. It will also be leaseholders. And that is, I think that kind of system pressure and the way it can affect people's behaviours is very, very striking. And I think, you know, one of the things which comes across very strongly when you look at the Grenfell report is how complaints there were a kind of canary in the coal mine. They were there as an indicator that there was something unhealthy, that there were relationships that weren't right, and that, you know, that imbalance.
So when you talk about leadership then, what change mm-hmm. are you looking for? Is it to come from the government to local councils? What's the change?
I think there's probably two areas. So I think there is a real need to state what is a decent home and what is the in the 21st century, and how do you invest in that to produce something which is going to support growth and going to support life chances. You know, I saw a case last week, for example, where technically it is a decent home, but the language, the words of the operatives in that home said it was appalling. That was their word. And to use the bath, you needed to be in the fetal position. But technically it was a decent home. Well, that's not acceptable.
So you want the government to redefine what a decent home is?
I think you have to have that.
And what else?
But I also, well, I think there has to be something around a sense of openness, transparency and a focus on how systems and processes are improved to the extent that we are not in a place where we would see an unprecedented level of complaints and residents trying to get their voices heard. But we see something which is far more responsive and predictive to maintaining and improving homes. If I take one example, which is complaints about windows, I am seeing an emerging and concerning trend where you are seeing complaints about windows where residents are saying, and they might be living in high-rise blocks, we can't close the windows, or our windows are letting in rain, or we are very concerned about the safety of our children. And in some cases, the system and the landlord is responding saying, we recognise that. We recognise a repair needs to be done. It will be done in 2036. Because that's when our major works will happen. That's when our planned works will happen.
So there's no room to make any change there with that system. Well, that brings us a bit onto architecture, design. Jack Pringle, let me turn to you. I mean, certain materials pass certain tests in this report, but not others. What do you take from that?
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, can I just step back a bit and tell you a bit how the building regulations work in this country? They used to be very prescriptive, and actually before 1984 I would sit down with an Act of Parliament which would tell me exactly how to design everything. And then everything changed. So the new regulations themselves are really skinny down. So, for instance, on staircases, they say they should be appropriate to afford reasonable safety to people gaining access and to moving about the buildings. Nothing more. There are then a load of approved documents that say, if you design a staircase in this way, we will approve it. But you don't have to do that. You can do it another way. And
so there's too much room for manoeuvre.
Well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, because what this does allow is innovation. And that was the idea of these more flexible regulations. But one of the alternative approaches would be, for instance, with new techniques or new materials that would come forward that would do things hopefully in a better way. But these have to be tested. And that's where we come to the testing regime. And what this report has shone a light on is some of the failures in the testing regime. We have two testing bodies. One is called the BRE, which used to be a public body, is now privatised, or at least is a private trust. And the other is the BBA, which is a completely commercial organisation. And when a manufacturer with a new product, which is hopefully going to be an improvement, wants to get a certificate for these, he or she will go to one of these organisations and instruct them how to test them and give them a certificate.
So that's a key change that needs to be made, that you can't go and instruct how to test.
We need to have a reliable, independent testing authority that will decide how to do the tests and give a clear certificate of what the test has shown with that material.
Because just for those who haven't looked at the report yet, there was criticism in the report of Studio E, the architect of the Grenfell refurbishment, needing to take more responsibility. It was responsible for the designing the external wall and the choice of materials used in construction.
That's right. And look, everybody mixed up in Grenfell did, you know, it was a perfect storm of things going wrong. Studio E were faced with certificates which were, in many cases, misleading, if not falsified, and they didn't see through it. But if you return to, I think, your generic question, if we are to go forward, we do need to have changes in the regulations. I think there is also a move to be a little bit more prescriptive in the basic regulations, not the guide to the regulations. So the government has already, for instance, said that external insulation needs to be non-combustible. No arguments about what it is now. It has to be non-combustible. I think that could go further. So, for example, we at the RIBA argued for all residential buildings above 18 metres to have two staircases. Well, that was accepted and it's gone into the guidance, but it hasn't gone into the regulations.
Into the regulations. So there's some specifics that they can go further on. And also around that testing side of things, which is so important. Jack Pringle, thank you for that. And Richard Blakeway, thank you to you.
It's 20 to 8 now. Well, she did it. 32 years on from making her Paralympics debut. Sarah Story won. Again.
All eyes now on Dame Sarah Story, getting every last ounce out of herself to claim the gold medal. Has she done it? It's going to be close, but Dame Sarah Story has done it. It's another chapter written in Sarah's remarkable story. It's 9 games now, 18 golds.
That was the moment that Sarah Story, on her bike in the women's cycling road event, successfully defended Olympic gold for the fourth time. It was captured by Channel 4. And here is the woman herself. And I can see you, Sarah, in Paris with a great big smile on your face. It still feels good.
Oh, it feels amazing. And I hadn't heard Simon's commentary until then. So thank you, Nick. It's great.
Yeah. You've already done it again and again. Can you still keep that fight, the energy, the excitement about winning gold?
Well, I think that's the thing about road racing is every single race is different. You're in a different location. You know, you've got different hills, different corners, different weather conditions. So every race is very different and exciting. And that's what kind of helps keep the motivation there and make sure that you just keep pushing to find that best version of yourself.
Mm. And you were 7 seconds down at one point.
I was. And the first time check was actually before the hardest part of the course. So I wasn't entirely surprised when I got that time check. And I knew that my strength was going to be on the climbs, the power sections, and those. There was two climbs in the second half of the course, or the second two thirds of the course. So for me, that wasn't a surprise, and I just kept chasing the virtual carrot, as it were, because the person who was ahead of me virtually, I couldn't see them on the road because we set off at 1 minute intervals.
Now, by the time the person you beat was born, you'd already won 16 Paralympic medals. I mean this in the nicest and gentlest possible way. Are you ever going to retire and give her a chance?
No, I mean, Heidi is 19. She's going to be 20 at the end of November. And I remember when I first raced her in Cascais in Portugal at the World Championships in 2021. And I was so excited to see such a young French talent coming through ahead of her home games for her. She's an amazing talent. She's won the Junior Worlds team pursuit title. She won the points race at those Junior Worlds as well. I think that was also in 2021. And she's just incredible. And it's so exciting to see what the future will look like when I do eventually hang up those road race wheels. But I haven't hung them up yet.
No. Might you carry on to the next Olympics in LA 2028?
Oh, well, anything's possible. But we have a very big month in September, because the Zurich World Championships takes place at the end of September. So I'm looking out for selection for that. So hopefully after yesterday, I've put my name on the team sheet.
Yeah, but there's a chance that Sarah Story at 50, you'd be by then, would you? Still in at Olympics. Now, you were smiling now, you were smiling last night, but you were also a bit cross about the course, weren't you? For those who weren't watching, didn't follow, why did you say the course for this road event was appalling?
Well, I think it's in the context of the distance of the race rather than the actual the course. I think it maybe I've got lost in a little bit of post-race translation. I did warn people I might turn into a grumpy old lady about the distance after the race. I think it's really difficult to understand why, when the triathlon bike leg is 20 kilometres, we get 14 kilometres for a road time trial.
Yeah, you thought it was too short to show it off as an event.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we work so hard, like all athletes, and to have 20 minutes for a road time trial, it's just so short. And everyone is capable across all the categories of racing much further. And we do as well in World Championships. So I think to have normally the Paralympic Games, you'll see the longer races and you'll see the most challenging distances, if you like. And the shortest races that meet those minimum criteria are usually saved for World Cup events or super hilly events. So you see it in Grand Tours where there's a relatively short time trial, but it's, you know, it's going up the side of a mountain and the elevation gain is maybe, you know, 500-600 meters in the space of that short distance. So I think it's really important that we see in the future the courses that showcase para sport in the way it should be, because we don't get the attention at the World Championships, at the World Cup events. And when you want to show the world what's possible, demonstrate to young children who are looking out and thinking, what's out there for me in my future career, maybe in sport, you want to be able to show that it's you know, it is the event that we train for. And 14 kilometres just felt too short.
Worry not, Dame Sarah. You are a wonderful and inspiring example to the children watching that event and many of us who are daunted by what you have to do. Dame Sarah Story, congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Yes, huge congratulations. A quarter to eight. It's time now for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge.
Good morning. While in Rome last week, I read about a would-be burglar who was caught after stopping to read a book on Greek mythology. He'd found it on a bedside table. The author of the book has since offered to send the thief a copy so he can finish it in prison. This story reminded me of an incident in Buenos Aires in 2010, when a man became so enchanted by the poetry in a bookshop he was robbing, he abandoned his crime. The owner found him the next morning still reveling in the shop's literary treasures. In 1990, during the Gardner Museum heist in Boston, thieves lingered far longer than they'd planned, mesmerised by the art they were meant to be stealing. What does it mean to be stopped in your tracks, not by a safe or a security system, but by the power of art itself? C.S. Lewis once wrote about how we don't merely want to see beauty, we want somehow to be united with it, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, to bathe in it, to become part of it. One way of understanding this is in terms of the Christian concept of common grace, the idea that God's presence permeates the whole world, extending to all of humanity, regardless of their faith or relationship to God. Common grace is said to inspire joy, but also to restrain the effects of sin. All of that might sound rather fuzzy. But before we dismiss such high claims as the sort of things intellectuals say because they just don't know what real life is like, it's well to reflect on the example of the great Russian novelist Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn was no criminal, but suffered for years while imprisoned in labour camps for his protests against the Soviet government. And in those oppressive times, he too found himself elevated by art. When he came some decades later to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, he took the opportunity to insist that art inflames even a frozen, darkened soul. It's a big claim, which perhaps takes a life like Solzhenitsyn's to make credible. He knew whereof he spoke. But countless other people throughout human history have said the same. The beauty of a novel, a poem, a painting has the power to disrupt lives, to direct us to something better. Even the most primitive cave paintings are not merely records, they are appreciations that are also signposts. We don't have to understand how any of this works, or even to believe God has anything to do with it, for beauty to inflame us. We need only to welcome the surprise.
That was Thought for the Day with Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge.
It is now 12 minutes to 8. The International Criminal Court was created two decades ago to ensure that individuals, not just states, could be held personally responsible for decisions they took that the court judges amount to a war crime, crimes against humanity or genocide. For years, the court was criticised for only pursuing so-called easy targets, usually leaders in Africa, allowing the leaders of rich and powerful nations, it was said, to go unpunished. The British barrister who became the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor was determined to end that, as was demonstrated when Karim Khan, a former prosecutor in this country, appeared in front of the cameras in May to announce that he was seeking arrest warrants for Israel's prime minister and her defence minister, as well as the leaders of Hamas. In the coming days, the judges of the ICC must decide whether to grant those arrest warrants, which could mean that every one of the 124 countries which signed the treaty establishing the court, including Britain, would be obliged to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu if he stepped foot in their country and to send him for trial in The Hague. I've been speaking to Karim Khan for my Political Thinking podcast. I began by asking him to go back to that day in May. Did he have any idea of the huge scale of the row it would provoke?
Well, I knew it was a powerful moment. I knew very divisive issue. It's an issue where emotions are strong and there would be a storm. I'd been told by many states and authorities it would be a nuclear bomb. The complexity of the situation, the tribalism that exists, the different narratives and competing narratives meant that one was faced with stark choices, legal principles and established, valued relationships. And how do you operate in that environment? And as a lawyer, those are beyond our pay grade. We have to simply apply the law with fidelity.
The choice some would have advised you to take, I'm sure they did in private, didn't they? Just wait, Karim. Wait till the fighting stops. Mm. Then that's the moment for the lawyers to go in, to assemble the evidence and to prosecute anyone who deserves to be prosecuted.
Yeah, that's exactly what several leaders and others told me and advised me and cautioned me. And but the difficulty when I became prosecutor, it was necessary to move at the speed of relevance, to try to show that the law is not an afterthought. You can't have one approach for countries where there's NATO support, European support, powerful countries behind you, and a different approach where you have clear jurisdiction because the storm may result.
What do you say to people who say, that's not law, that's politics, that's getting involved, you're in the wrong job?
Well, many would say I'm in the wrong job if they don't like what I'm doing. And I think what we're doing is the antithesis of politics. It's about the equal application of the law, irrespective of whether one receives a round of applause from some quarters or a deafening din of condemnation and assaults of different types from another. The law should be blind to power, to wealth. What we have to do is try to apply the law in a way that is equal, because there is clearly an assault underway that's been going on for quite some time, attacking what has been called the rules-based system. And so it does require a way that, you know, the global South, Latin America, Asia, Africa, people in the UK, that they don't just think that we are a tool, an instrument of power. And we try, in a very imperfect world, to apply the law equally based upon some common standards. And that's the job of the International Criminal Court.
The big charge that was made against you, and you must have known it was coming, you're not just British, but you're British Muslim, was from Netanyahu himself, who said, you take your place amongst the great anti-Semites in modern times.
Karim Khan, prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, stands alongside, he said, those infamous German judges who donned their robes and upheld laws that denied the Jewish people their most basic rights and enabled the Nazis to perpetrate the worst crime in history. What did you think? How did you feel when you heard that?
Well, it's sad. I mean, this is the kind of typical invective that sometimes people retreat to. I know who I am. I've engaged with the Jewish community in so many different ways, respect the Jewish teachings like I do all religions. So there's not an ounce, not a jot, not a scintilla of truth in the charge of anti-Semitism, but our job is to apply the law and not be dissuaded by these kind of cheap shots or criticisms that manifestly are false.
You did, of course, announce at the time you sought arrest warrants against Israel's Prime Minister and the Defence Minister that you were also seeking arrest warrants against three leaders of Hamas, two of them now dead. One of the criticisms that was raised against you then was a false equivalence, that in other words, people deemed round the world to be terrorists, people who'd gone into a democratic state and slaughtered people in a kibbutz, young people at a festival, were somehow being treated in the same way as you were treating those who are seen as terrorists themselves.
Now, this was an argument or a narrative that was peddled, but the truth of the matter is, what could I have done? If one had applied for warrants for Hamas and not looked at the evidence, if the evidence compelled action in Israel, when at that time 30,000 plus 40,000 people had been killed in Gaza, they'd say, well, this is a weak court that is influenced, a weak prosecutor influenced by power dynamics. If one had applied for warrants in relation to Israeli officials and not for Gaza, they'd say, well, this is a obscenity, that how on earth is that possible? But I think any right-thinking person would see the allegations coming out of the 7th of October as outrageous. Civilians, babies, old, infirm, ripped from their homes and taken underground or to other locations is a great breach of the Geneva Conventions, hostage taking, willful killing. It demanded action, and I needed evidence. It's not because it's a knee-jerk reaction. So we were investigating things impartially, objectively, and at the same time noting that there wasn't any meaningful accountability efforts, you know, regarding Hamas or in relation to allegations against Israel. We have discharged our responsibilities. We have left it to the judges now to decide, and others must do what they think is appropriate.
They will decide.
They will decide. We must follow the process and then respect what judges do.
And explain your passion for demonstrating that this system, whoever it is that's involved, works and must be seen to work for all countries in the world, not just for the rich, the powerful, the Western.
Well, international law is a work in progress. Very few countries come to law with completely clean hands in their history. We're living in a world where there's been so many blights on humanity. But do we want for our children to have a world driven by brute power over innocence? Or do we want a world that has a fighting chance to be regulated evenly by something that I think is needed, which is the law?
The new British government, the new British Prime Minister, of course, like you, a former prosecutor here in the UK, he's changed his attitude to your court, the International Criminal Court, hasn't he? The British government under Rishi Sunak said, we don't approve of this approach. Keir Starmer has said he does approve. How important is it, this change in the British government's attitude?
Well, the former government was very supportive on a variety of work. Yes, there's a difference of tone and I think of substance in relation to international law by the new government. And I think that's welcome, because my own view is that this country that I love is a country that is defined by doing the right thing, by founding conventions, whether it's the European Convention of Human Rights or being a founding member of the International Criminal Court, and be seen striving to be better, to be constantly being a better version of itself. It's not easy. Sometimes it brings you in conflict. But that quest to have a compass, a moral compass, a legal compass, I think that's what we need to, as a country, to be, have a leading voice in the world. I think it's what's needed by all permanent members of the Security Council, and I think it's definitely welcome as prosecutor of the ICC.
That is a part of a long interview with Kareem Khan on my Political Thinking podcast. You can listen to the whole conversation now on BBC Sounds.
8:03. Here's with the latest on the weather, Helen Willett.
Emma, thanks very much. So it is a differing weather day today, with the north and west seeing dry and quite sunny weather, but the south, close to low pressure, seeing quite a lot of rain. Worryingly heavy rain across the channel at the moment is going to spread its way northwards into southern England and South Wales. At times it will turn heavy and thundery, and we could see 2 or 3 inches of rain in the wettest spots. So clearly that could lead to some sudden flooding and lots of spray and standing water. And it will still be around, if not heavier, as we get towards the evening rush hour. So temperatures probably around 18 to 20 degrees, quite a brisk wind as well. And it will feel quite humid. For the rest of England and Wales, the best of any sunshine will be across western parts of North Wales, the northwest of England, and perhaps East Anglia for a time, but there'll be some heavy showers around here. And there's lots of low cloud and mist and drizzle over the hills of northern England as well, and parts of the Midlands, which will take a time to lift and clear. For Northern Ireland, we'll see some bright and dry weather, some sunshine, temperatures up to 19 or 20. And similarly so for the west of Scotland, we'll get 19 or 20 in that sunshine today. But for central and eastern Scotland, and probably a bit more cloud around and the odd spot of rain and drizzle. But again, mostly dry away from the east coast, but just chilly 14 on the coast.
Helen, thank you.
It started in a fourth floor kitchen in a West London tower block.
It just said fire in flat 16 at Grenfell Tower.
It became the worst residential fire in the UK since the Second World War.
Battling the blaze at the Grenfell Tower in West London for 7 hours.
But was this tragedy actually foreseeable? I'm Kate Lamble, and for Radio 4, I'll reveal how a catalogue of failures led to the death of 72 people.
The system isn't broken. It was built this way.
Grenfell, Building a Disaster. Available now on BBC Sounds.
It's brilliant. Do check it out. Coming up in the next hour of this programme, we'll be joined by the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, to talk about the commitments made by the government following the release of that final report into the Grenfell Tower disaster. One of the most successful football managers in the world, Emma Hayes, will be dropping by the studio, and we'll be hearing from the mum of the new tennis sensation, Jack Draper. A lot to look forward to, so stay with us.
You're listening to Today with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson. Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 5th of September. The headlines this morning: water company bosses could be jailed and lose their bonuses under proposed new powers for regulators to stamp out sewage spills. Ministers have warned that there may be more buildings not yet identified wrapped in flammable cladding. And universities say they face a slide into decline without action to address their financial pressures. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Water company executives could be banned from receiving bonuses and sent to jail under new government legislation aimed at reducing pollution. The bill, which will apply in England and Wales, gives regulators more powers and makes it easier for them to impose penalties. Last year, there were more than 450,000 sewage spills in England. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
This legislation makes it easier for the Environment Agency to take enforcement action and introduces tougher penalties for executives. If they obstruct an investigation, they could now face up to 2 years in jail. Bonuses for bosses will only be allowed if their companies are judged by the regulator to have met both environmental and financial standards. The Environment Secretary Steve Reed said the new laws should end what he called the disgraceful behaviour of water companies and their bosses. Critics say that up till now, the problem hasn't been the laws, but the willingness and ability of the industry regulators to enforce them. In response, the water companies said they agreed the current system was not working. They're calling on the regulators to back their £105 billion investment plan for new infrastructure. If approved, it will be paid for through higher customer bills.
Charles Watson is the chair and founder of the campaign group River Action. He told us the new proposals weren't enough to tackle problems with water quality.
Finally, after years of denial over the whole scandal of the pollution of our rivers, lakes and seas, we've got a government of the day acknowledging the scale of the problem, and in particular acknowledging the abject failure of the regulators who've allowed all this to happen on their watch. But sadly, what we've got today is basically it's a long list of measures that will cost the government nothing, but they're not really going to fix anything because it's the system that's broken.
The communications watchdog Ofcom has published plans for Royal Mail to end second-class deliveries on Saturdays. First-class post would continue to be 6 days a week. The proposals follow a consultation on the future of the universal service. Ofcom said the change would enable Royal Mail to make savings and improve reliability. Formal proposals will be set out next year. Lindsay Fussell is from Ofcom and told us Royal Mail had to reform.
No change is not really an option. Otherwise, it is going to become unsustainable and we're all going to have to pay a lot more for it. And what people have told us is, firstly, that first-class services are really important to them. They do want a next-day service 6 days a week for the occasional urgent item. But most items aren't urgent. They can wait that bit longer. But they are more prepared to think about changes to second-class.
Ministers have warned that not all buildings wrapped in dangerous cladding like the type which caught fire at Grenfell Tower have been identified. Yesterday's report on the disaster accused companies of being dishonest and deliberately concealing the fire risks posed by their construction materials. Hundreds of high-rise buildings where flammable cladding has been found still haven't been made safe because of disputes over who should pay for the remedial work. Chichi Azundu reports.
Failure, incompetence and deliberate concealment are some of the words used by the inquiry in its excoriating condemnation of the companies, regulators and governments involved. The 1,700-page document found that fire tests had proven how dangerous the cladding was, but that was kept secret. The government had been warned about it 25 years ago, but the combustible cladding wasn't banned. The inquiry also found systemic dishonesty by the cladding companies and indifference from the local council. Last night, Matthew Pennycook, the housing minister, said the government would bring forward in the autumn a strategy to deal with the hundreds of buildings that still have unsafe cladding.
We've got to review how leaseholders are better protected from costs. We've got to accelerate the pace of remediation. But looking under the bonnet, we found a number of challenges. For example, we don't know for certain that all of the buildings that are dangerous have been identified. So we've got to do more work in that area.
72 people lost their lives because of the Grenfell Tower fire. Survivors and bereaved families have called for the police investigation to be accelerated after prosecutors said it would take until the end of 2026 for a final decision to be made on criminal charges.
The head of the organisation that represents universities is warning they face a slide into decline unless the government takes action to ease pressure on funding. Dame Sally Mapston from Universities UK will tell a conference of vice-chancellors that the sector is at a fork in the road. Here's our education editor, Bramwyn Jeffries.
University finances are under pressure. There's been a sharp fall in applications from international students since visa restrictions came into force in January. That's piled on pressure in England, where tuition fees have increased by £250 in the last 12 years, falling far behind inflation. At least 40% of universities are forecasting a deficit in their budgets. In a speech this morning, Professor Dame Sally Mapstone from Universities UK is expected to warn without decisions on funding, institutions face a slide into decline.
The authorities in the US state of Georgia say a 14-year-old boy will be charged with murder after a shooting at a high school yesterday. Two pupils and two teachers were killed. Nine others were taken to hospital from Appalachee High School in Winder near Atlanta. The FBI said agents had interviewed the boy and his father last year for making online threats about a school shooting. Neda Taufik reports.
The gunman was identified by authorities as Colt Gray, a 14-year-old student at the school. They said within minutes of receiving the active shooter alert, two resource officers posted at the school encountered the suspect, who immediately surrendered and was taken into custody. But before that, two students, two teachers were shot and killed. Nine others were also shot and are being treated for various injuries in hospitals. At the moment, authorities have not identified any connection between the gunman and the victims. They said he would be charged with murder and tried as an adult. Investigators have interviewed him and are in touch with his family. The school will be closed for the remainder of the week and grief counseling will be offered to students.
A Ugandan distance runner who competed at the Olympics has died after her boyfriend allegedly set her on fire. 33-year-old Rebecca Cheptegei, who competed in the marathon in Paris, was doused with petrol at her home in Western Kenya on Sunday, according to police. Her partner was also injured. Official figures show that more pupils in England were off school without permission in the last week of the summer term than at any point during the academic year. About 5% weren't in class in the week ending the 19th of July, amounting to roughly 450,000 pupils. The fine issued to parents who take their children on holiday during term time has increased, as our cost of living correspondent Coletta Smith reports.
Term time holidays now have steeper consequences. Fines issued to each parent have increased from £60 to £80 per pupil, and parents who are fined three times in a three-year period could now face prosecution and the possibility of a criminal record. Holidaying during term time is substantially cheaper, and travel agents say they've seen more inquiries from families weighing up the price difference as the rise in the cost of living continues to eat into people's disposable income. Data from the global travel agency, the Flight Centre, shows some long-haul trips, such as Thailand, double in price during the school holidays, with New York up 60% and Orlando 36% extra during August, compared with early July. The government say parents have a legal responsibility to ensure their child is in school and are trying to ensure the new rules are applied consistently across councils in England.
A council of New Zealand's indigenous Maori chiefs has chosen the late king's youngest child and only daughter as the new queen. 27-year-old Nawe Hono Itipo was chosen by Maori elders in a ceremony which was followed by the burial of her father, King Tuhetia, who died last week at the age of 69. Our Australia and New Zealand correspondent Katie Watson reports.
The naming of Nawe Hono Itipo as Queenie doesn't just mark a generational shift. The choice of this young monarch is seen as a gesture of renewal, a positive influence on younger Maori members. Nawe Hono Itepo has a master's in Maori cultural studies and teaches kapa haka, the Maori performing arts. Indeed, it was the haka dance that accompanied some of the elaborate and emotional ceremony. Nawe Hono Itepo was blessed with the same Bible that was used to anoint the first Maori king in 1858. The role is largely ceremonial and was created as a way to unite tribes and resist British colonisation. The naming of the new Queenie marked the end of a week of formal proceedings after Kingi Tuhetia's death. His coffin was then taken by a flotilla of waka, or carved war canoes, along the Waikato River before being carried up a sacred mountain to the sound of mourners chanting. It was there he was laid to rest.
Katie Watson reporting.
Jane, thank you. It's 10 minutes past eight. The Grenfell Tower fire, a disaster caused by incompetence, dishonesty and greed. All 72 deaths in the biggest residential fire since the Second World War were entirely avoidable. Those were the conclusions of the long-awaited final part of the public inquiry published yesterday. The inquiry found that firms involved in the disastrous refurbishment of the tower operated with a systematic dishonesty, there was decades of failure by central government, and police are now under pressure to accelerate the criminal investigations, as more than 7 years on, no one has been charged or prosecuted. Despite 72 people losing their lives, 18 of them children, one as young as 6 months old. Yesterday, the Prime Minister apologised and pledged that the Grenfell report would be a moment of change for our country. But how? And when? Angela Rayner is the Deputy Prime Minister. She's also the Secretary of State for Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities. Angela Rayner, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Can you commit to implementing all 58 recommendations in this public inquiry?
Well, I think it's right that we look at those 58 recommendations, and the Prime Minister set out yesterday that we will be coming forward within 6 months to say how we're going to address them. And, you know, we've seen the report yesterday, and I read the executive summary and went through the points with my department yesterday, and it was absolutely horrifying to, as you outline, it wasn't one failure, it was just every single layer of protection that should have been there for the people of Grenfell was catastrophic in its failure. And by the sounds of what Sir Martin said, some very deliberate.
When you say 6 months to commit to those recommendations, which have now taken more than 7 years to come to light like this, why do you need a further 6 months?
Well, we've only just got the report yesterday, so and that report is very substantial, and we've got to go through each and every one of them. We need to speak to the regulators. We need to speak to those that are, tasked with building safety. We need to speak with other departments, and we need to make sure we get this right, and we need to do it as quickly as we possibly can. Since we came into power, there is a number of things that I've already recognised. Remediation is far too slow, and I want to come forward with a remediation acceleration plan into the autumn. There is a number of challenges with remediation. There's action that has already been taken. The previous government has set out new legislation that is already in place, but I think that we will need more legislation. And I think the biggest two takeaways for me beyond the legislation was a cultural shift to empowering people. I think the people of Grenfell were dismissed and not listened to and were not empowered as tenants. And I think that, you know, we've got to make sure that greed and profit is not put above safety, because, you know, we talk about it in other contexts that the number one priority of a government is to keep its citizens safe. And I think this is absolutely part of that process.
Well, we've seen successive governments fail these people. And I suppose Grenfell United, a group of survivors and bereaved families looking at their response to the report yesterday, is asking the government to ban the companies named and criticised in the report from public contracts. Can you commit to that?
Well, I heard Natasha yesterday, and she spoke very powerfully. And Grenfell United and the other survivor groups and those bereaved have been incredible over the last 7 years in not only pushing for justice for them, but also about the changes that we need to make. And the Prime Minister set out yesterday that the Cabinet Secretary is already writing to the companies to ensure that they're aware that they will not be receiving government contracts and that we need to do everything we possibly can to ensure that that isn't the case.
How many of them currently hold government contracts?
Well, my department doesn't have any government contracts. We've been very clear on that. And we've, spoke to the Cabinet Secretary. And I know the Cabinet Secretary is writing round to ensure that we do not give these companies that are named in the report that was published yesterday any contract.
Sorry, so can you say if any of them still have current government contracts?
I don't believe they do, but I can't say with absolute guarantee. But as the report came out yesterday and identified these companies, yes, the Cabinet Secretary will be writing to those companies, making it clear that they won't be receiving the government contracts.
So they are going to be blocked from those future government contracts.
That's what the Prime Minister set out yesterday.
OK, and for you now, when you talk about that change, that cultural shift, we were hearing earlier on the programme from the Housing Ombudsman that social housing tenants are treated as second-class citizens. How are you going to stop that?
Well, again, there's a number of reforms that we've identified, that whether that's the Renters Reform Bill or the Leasehold Bill that we set out in the King's speech earlier, there is a total imbalance for tenants at the moment, and social tenants in particular have a stigma attached to them. And as someone who was a social tenant all of my childhood and into my adulthood, I completely appreciate that there is a culture in this country where they're considered lesser people, and that's disgraceful. And we have to make sure that there is powers as well as, representation.
I suppose how is
at every
question?
Level. Well, first of all, it's about making sure that tenants have a voice. It's about making sure that legislation is there to protect them. You know, for example,
lots would say, I'm sorry to break in, but lots would say that's already been there. You know, those things are there, but they haven't. They've still been ignored. That's why this relationship between those of Grenfell and their landlord was described as toxic.
Well, there has been some powers, but far too many. For example, people are scared to raise issues around their tenancy because they'll get evicted. And we've spoke about that previously. And the shortage of housing that we have in this country as well, people are really scared to raise problems that they have in their buildings. And therefore, making sure we empower tenants and making sure that they have the right legal framework and protections, and that they're actually, if there is a tenants board, that they're empowered on that board and then they're listened to and that people can't ignore. I mean, one of the things that really shocked me was the tenant management organisation and the relationship that Sir Martin documents in that report they had with the tenants, who were raising legitimate, clearly now vindicated legitimate concerns, and those concerns were being ignored and dismissed.
The building regulations, we were also hearing from an expert on this earlier in the programme, should they go return to being much more prescriptive like they were pre-1984?
Well, there's been a number of changes made to building regulations, and there's a number of recommendations within the 58 that has come out in phase two, and that we'll have to consider them. And, you know, there's issues around training, there's issues around regulation. And
surely you must have been aware of some of this, though. I know we had to have the report yesterday, but for Sir Keir Starmer to say this is going to be a moment for the country, you know, he's staking a major moment here in his early days of his premiership. Surely you can make some commitments this morning in light of 7 years of getting to this point.
Well, there has already been changes that have been made. There is a new regulator now, the Building Safety Act, and there is much more to do. And I think that's the point that Keir was making. And in a broader point, you know, what Keir was saying as Prime Minister is you have these scandals, these inquiries. We've had the contaminated blood, we've had Horizon, we've had Hillsborough, and time again, Prime Ministers standing up to apologise for systemic failures. And that's why we've got to address how is it in Britain with our democracy that we could have the level of failure that we're seeing. You know, the Prime Minister set out the duty of candour in the King's Speech. And there's been a number. There's been a number of changes made, but there is a question for all politicians, which is what the Prime Minister said yesterday when he spoke about working with the whole House about how can we keep ending up in these circumstances where successive governments are apologising for things that, quite frankly, are abhorrent and shouldn't be happening.
We can ask those questions. We want leadership from our politicians. We don't need those questions to be asked in that way necessarily. There's action and a clamour for that. Can I just get to a couple of points on that? You talked about speeding up remediation. Those buildings today with unsafe cladding, what is the government's timeline for getting rid of all unsafe cladding?
Well, today, we've still got out of the 630 buildings that have been identified currently, only 50% of them are currently in remediation and 29% of them are completed. So there's still way too much to be done. Over 400 legal notices and legal action has been taken against these building owners to push them to make remediation quicker. But it's not quick enough. You know.
So what's your commitment?
My commitment is that I'm pulling together the industry and our departments and looking at where the gaps are, whether that's through legislation. You know, the money is there. There is money available to remediate, and these companies also have money, these building owners, and they cannot get away with not taking the action that they need to take. So our remediation acceleration plan that I'm coming forward with in the autumn will be about how we can speed up that process. It is incredibly frustrating that 7 years on, we have 50% of buildings that have been identified as needing this remediation work hasn't even started that process.
Have you got a timeline?
I haven't got a definitive timeline yet, but 7 years on is not acceptable. And, you know, one of the first things I did when I was came into the department was review what has happened. And we had a fire in Dagenham not long ago. Yes. And again, I brought the regulators and the fire safety chiefs around the table and said, this is just not good enough.
Can you not have a timeline because you don't know what you can do, or you don't have a timeline because you haven't figured out how you're going to do it?
Well, I can't give you a timeline because there's a number of outstanding ways to which we will have to see whether that's through tightening up legislation, whether that's around the legal framework, and, you know, about how we can get these companies And these building owners...
They've got thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, end our cladding scandal campaign statement yesterday, still living in homes with the same risk that was in Grenfell 7 years ago. They are looking to you, as the Deputy Prime Minister, the Housing Secretary, to say when by, to put a deadline there.
Which is why my remediation acceleration plan is about how I can speed up that process. I can't, and, you know, I'm always straight with people. I can't give timeline today, but what I can say is that it is incredibly slow process at the moment, 7 years on, and that's not acceptable.
Do you not think that people find that very odd, that you can't give that?
Well, it's because there's a number of things you'd have to do beyond what the previous government have done. The previous government has changed legislation. They have taken legal action against the companies and the property owners who are not taking remediation action. And we're still 7 years on. And as I've outlined, we're still only 50% of those identified that have started that process. That's too slow. So therefore, there has to be a change. And that's why I will be coming forward with proposals on how we speed up that process.
I think I'm just commenting, you know, and I look forward to talking to you again on that. But I'm just commenting people may be frustrated that you can't at least give a timeline, even if you're figuring out how to actually do it and have that change. Just on timings. Angela Rayner, should people go to prison for what happened in Grenfell?
Well, that'll be a matter for the police. And I...
But what's your view? Because people have said to us yesterday, I was at Grenfell, I was below the tower for the whole programme yesterday. And people, the bereaved, the survivors have said they do not feel there will be justice served if there is no one in the dock. What do you think?
I think the issues that the survivors said that was very pertinent to me yesterday was that justice delayed is justice denied. And I think the Met Police doing everything they can to get to the position of their investigation being concluded and their outcome so that people can see it's not an issue that I should be commenting on in terms of what I think should happen.
But
because
you are
that
very
is a
straight talking, and I just wondered if for you, with what's happened and what this report, I mean, this report was completely clear that the death of those 72 people, men, women and children, could have been avoided, should have been avoided. Does it feel right to you that there might be a case where nobody ends up going to prison?
There should be consequences, but that is an ongoing live legal investigation, which the Prime Minister was very clear and the Speaker was about being careful not to do anything that would impact on that investigation. I want to support the Met Police in doing their investigation and concluding that as quickly as they possibly can, and then for them to take the action, because they are the police and the Crown Prosecution Service
about,
to take the action that they need to take to bring
what do they do
to
about
justice.
Government? What does that mean? The inquiry concluded that governments ignored, delayed or disregarded concerns. What does that look like for justice for those people? The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davies, said misconduct in public office should be investigated, tried and punished. What does punishment look like for the government?
Well, again, you know, the investigations that are being carried out will be carried out. And if there is answers for anyone involved in terms of criminality, the police will investigate that.
Including government?
Well, that depends. It's the Met Police who are investigating, and they will be, you know, any act of criminality, I'm sure the Met Police will be doing all they can to get to the bottom of it. But that's not something that I'm involved in. But I do think that the families deserve that justice, and they deserve it as quickly and as swiftly as they possibly can. And me as the Secretary of State, looking at what's been done so far and looking at the next 58 recommendations to ensure that we could do everything we possibly can to take this forward so we don't end up in the same circumstances again. I think, just finally, the thing that really struck me was the way in which the deregulation and profit and greed was put ahead of safety. And for me, that is completely unacceptable. And as I said before, a government's first priority is to keep its citizens safe. And that is at the forefront of my mind,
Angela,
as the Secretary of State today.
Angela Rayner, as the Secretary of State for Housing, in this respect, the relevant part of your brief, and Deputy Prime Minister, I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
And that question about whether and when the victims of Grenfell will see justice is a question we ask on this week's episode of the Today podcast. I recorded a long interview with the woman who was the MP at the time, who was got out of bed when the news broke and ran to Grenfell Tower to see what was going on. Emma Dentgoad is still a councillor in the area and knows the issues well. So some very personal reflections on her as she remembered that terrible morning. To listen to the Today podcast, just search for it. You know where now. It's on BBC Sounds. The time is 26 minutes past eight. Benjamin Netanyahu was under huge pressure to agree a ceasefire with Hamas. Pressure at home as well as from abroad. In Israel, tens of thousands have taken to the streets after six more hostages who the Israeli had hoped to rescue were found to have been murdered. Last night, he held a news conference and argued that he wouldn't compromise his country's security simply to get that ceasefire, insisting he wouldn't order Israeli forces to leave the border between Gaza and Egypt.
I don't want to leave in order to come back in when I know that we didn't come back in, and it's not going to take another 24 years to come back in, and God knows what price we'll have, how many more massacres, how many more kidnappings, how many more hostages, how many more rapes. It's not going to happen. So people said, yeah, but if you stay, this will kill the deal. And I say, such a deal will kill us. And there won't be a deal that way. This is a false narrative.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, was watching that news conference. I was struck by that last phrase, there won't be a deal. He's not holding out a lot of hope, is he?
Well, it's pretty emphatic. I think that amounts to a no. And the focus at the moment is on that strip of land you were talking about between Gaza and Egypt, which is called the Philadelphia Corridor. It's about 8 miles long. Khalil al-Hayya, who's the lead negotiator of Hamas, said to the Pan-Arab broadcaster Al Jazeera a couple of days ago that without withdrawing from the corridor, there will be no agreement. So there you are. Now, the negotiators, of course, try and find ambiguous language that both sides can grab. But the thing is, they have other differences as well. For example, how many Palestinian prisoners are exchanged for Israeli hostages. And ambiguous language only works when both sides want to find a way through. I doubt it seems pretty clear that neither side really wants to find a way through at the moment, except on their absolute terms and not through a compromise.
And can Netanyahu continue to defy pressure at home? Is his coalition secure enough that he can just say, look, I hear you, I watch those protests, but I'm not listening?
Yeah, well, the Israeli parliament is in recess until the end of October. He has the support of, and in fact depends on the support of, the number of hard right extremist Jewish nationalist politicians who have been as well taking to social media. Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's one of the leaders of that, he says the ongoing negotiations will only encourage Hamas to generate more and more terrorism, including from Judea and Samaria, which is what he calls the West Bank. So I think the way it's looking at the moment is that, yeah, Netanyahu feels he can ride out this domestic pressure, which is coming from the side of Israel that doesn't support him anyway, because he has his right-wing base secure. And, yeah, there's also pressure from Joe Biden, saying, when asked the other day, is Netanyahu doing enough? He said no, but elections are coming in the US, and I think that one of Netanyahu's strategies, as ever, is to try to play for time and play for time until the poll in the US, when he will no doubt be hoping that Donald Trump will win and then the climate will change.
You mentioned the West Bank, what Israelis often call Judea and Samaria. I was struck, Jeremy, looking at the images of that news conference in which the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who stands in front of a map, acting as a kind of teacher to foreign journalists who were in the audience. No sign of the West Bank. It is just shown as a full part of Israel. No border, no occupied territories, nothing like that.
Yeah, it's not the first time he's done that, too. The thing is that those right-wingers who support him want it all to be annexed as part of Israel. That's the position. The position of the government that he leads is that all that territory from the Mediterranean Sea to the River Jordan, effectively, is the birthright and the gift and given by God for the Jews. So that doesn't leave a great deal of room for any kind of aspiration to a Palestinian state, the so-called two-state solution, independent Palestine alongside Israel, which is the template for a long-term peace in the minds of international powers, because the Israeli Prime Minister and his government have said again and again and again that is not going to happen. And the pressure they're putting at the moment, military pressure on the West Bank, is they're using some of the language they've used about Gaza. The defense minister said the other day that they are, quote, mowing the grass. That's the phrase they always used about Gaza, about going in there and going after the people they need and then coming back again when those shoots, which they believe, of course, are they would say terrorism, are coming up again. And so the way they go in and smash it. They're using more and more airstrikes in the West Bank to protect Israeli soldiers, they say. So, you know, all around, what you're looking at right now is an ongoing, long-term war that with no sign of imminent or even medium-term resolution. This is really serious.
Jeremy Bone, our international editor, thank you.
28 minutes to nine. Here's Gary with the sport.
Good morning. And one story dominates our roundup. Another brilliant performance from Jack Draper at the US Tennis Open.
He serves down the centre onto the backhand and paddles his backhand cross court for a clean winner. Draper raises his arms in victory.
7-5, 6-2.
He's into a Grand Slam semi-final.
He certainly is. Jack Draper defeated Alex de Minaur in straight sets. Jack's mum, Nikki, who also coached him in his earlier days, joins us. Morning, Nikki.
Morning, Gary.
What do you make of that?
Oh, absolutely incredible performance. Can't believe it. Yeah, it was amazing. Amazing to watch. He's played Alex three times previously. Just lost so narrowly. I knew that he had it in him to beat him, but, you know, what a way to do it, and in three sets.
Have you had a chance to speak to him?
Oh, yeah. I think he called me within about 10 minutes. I think he was in the ice bath. Just a very brief chat, just me as a mother saying, oh, brilliant, well done, that was amazing, and how are you? Are you okay? All those sorts of things, because I literally haven't seen him in person for, I don't know, about 5 or 6 weeks.
Before the US Open began, what were you expecting him to do at the tournament?
I never know what's going to happen, and that's the honest truth. You switch the telly on, you know, you're hoping, you're knowing that the work's gone in, but you never know when the results are going to come. He all the while says, you know, you've just got to believe in the process. I know I'm doing the right things. I'm sort of going in the right direction. And I know that in time, the results will come.
Yes, that's interesting. We have a little clip from an interview that he gave us afterwards. And he talked in that interview about it not all being plain sailing in recent years.
You know, I've had injuries, I've had setbacks, I've had times when, you know, I've maybe thought to stop or, you know, yeah, am I cut out for this sport? Am I good enough? And all these sort of stuff. And, you know, I kept on believing in myself, kept on working. And those are hard moments. You know, this is kind of not a hard moment compared to that. This is a privilege, and I'm not afraid of being in these positions. You know, I want to keep on doing this.
He showed great belief, Nikki, and he mentioned there about giving up. What did you advise him as a parent at that stage?
I don't honestly think he seriously thought about giving up, but tennis is a brutal sport. You've got to train day in, day out. You can't go on holiday and just take a break for a few days even. You know, you've got to be working on your speed, your agility, your flexibility, your endurance, the mental side. It just never stops.
He now plays Jannik Sinner, the world number one, and he knows him very well. They played doubles together.
Yeah, I think they're quite good friends, actually. Jack played him about 3 years ago at Queen's Club. I was there watching, and Jack lost the first four games, so he's four love down, but he was playing so well, and I thought, you know, you're playing so well, but you haven't actually won a game yet. And then suddenly he turned it around and he actually won the match 7-6, 7-6. It was grass. You know, Jannik wasn't particularly used to grass. But they've become friends. They played some doubles together. They've shared the old dinner together. I think Yannick's made Jack some pasta, and he's taught him how to cook pasta before he had his flat. They're young boys, aren't they?
They are. Are you going to catch the plane and go to New York?
Oh, it's in the back of my mind. But do you know what? I've been watching every match with my dad, with my dog, swearing and cursing, jumping up and down, clapping, having a glass of wine at the same time. And, you know, I've got both my boys out there. I think they're doing all right without me. So probably not.
Fingers crossed for Sunday. Nikki Draper, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gary.
What a fascinating insight. Jack, Yannick Sinner making impasta.
Yeah, I know, it's lovely, isn't it?
Incredible.
And that choice between do you watch, you know, at home with the dog, or do you go?
Yeah, let's give you a couple of other bits and pieces. At Paralympics, Britain won 13 gold medals on the latest day of competition. Nation League football programme starts today. Northern Ireland face Luxembourg. You can hear commentary on Scotland's game with Poland on 5 Live from 7.45. And the third test match between England and Sri Lanka gets underway at the Oval tomorrow. Leicestershire's Josh Hull will make his debut for England. My guest at this time tomorrow will be former Prime Minister Sir John Major on a range of cricketing issues.
Look forward to that. Look forward to going to the Oval, which I'm lucky enough to be doing tomorrow as well. Later this morning, John Wilson will be in conversation with an operatic star.
One of the world's greatest ever sopranos, Dame Kiri Takanawa, tells me why, after a 50-year career, she knew it was time to leave the opera stage.
And here's singers you can't name, but you could, who should be off the stage. And you could say very quietly, you know, don't you think time's up now? But that's the thing, that I never wanted that to happen to me, because I always felt that because I'd been given this amazing privilege of singing for the best in the world at the best of my quality, that it was time for me to leave it with dignity.
Kiri Takanawa is my guest on This Cultural Life on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this morning at 11.
Looking forward to that now. A look at the weather today. Heavy rain in the southwest, sunny in the northwest, and dry but cloudy elsewhere.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Nick Robinson at 23 minutes to 9. Jane Steele's got a summary of the news.
Water company bosses could lose their bonuses or be sent to jail under new legislation to reduce pollution. It's hoped the laws will make it easier for regulators in England and Wales to impose fines. The Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner has said that remedial work on hundreds of buildings still wrapped in some dangerous cladding as Grenfell Tower is far too slow. Ms Rayner, who is also the Housing Secretary, told this programme she wanted to see work accelerated to make buildings safe. Work on many blocks has been delayed due to disputes over who should pay for it. Saturday deliveries for second-class post could be scrapped under proposals by the regulator to reform the postal service. Ofcom says first-class post would remain a six-day-a-week service. The plans will be put out to consultation. A Ugandan distance runner who competed at the Olympics has died after allegedly being set on fire by her boyfriend. Rebecca Cheptegei died after being attacked at her home in Western Kenya on Sunday.
Thank you, Jane. 21 minutes to 9 now. The smugglers, the people smugglers, were busy again yesterday on France's Channel coast, cramming more paying customers into overloaded, unsafe, inflatable boats heading to the UK. That, despite the deaths of the 12 people who drowned in the Channel the day before. So is it back to business as usual? Andrew Harding now reports from northern France.
A vigil is taking place here in the centre of Calais. A minute's silence about to begin. This happens every time there are deaths in the Channel. It's the third such vigil that I've attended already this year, as the death toll from migrants in these flimsy, overcrowded boats continues to rise.
So it's words that we say very often, but we will not forgive, we will not forget. We'll continue gathering here in solidarity, struggling with those that struggle along the border.
The mood here is somber. There is a lot of anger, though, directed towards the French security forces, the militarisation that people fear is taking place along the coastline, but also towards the authorities in Britain. Calls for people to make it easier for migrants to cross safely and legally to the UK. One of those attending this vigil is Danny Patou, who works for a local charity supporting migrants here.
All these extra security forces active on our coastline, the buggies and drones and helicopters, all this is achieving is more death. It is provoking those migrants who want to cross to take greater risks. I'm furious. These people are trapped here. They're not welcome anywhere. It's pitiful.
Further down the coast, fishermen are dragging boxes of fresh whelks onto the quayside. A good haul. But the mood here is subdued too. On Tuesday, Captain Gaetan Bayet and his crew came across the smuggler's boat minutes after it had capsized, and they were soon dragging dead bodies from the water. It's sad, he says. It shouldn't have happened. So who is to blame, I ask. Bayet frowns and shrugs. There was nothing left of the boat when we arrived, he continues. There were obviously far too many people on board. For now, police here in France have finished interviewing survivors, but the investigation, the search for the ringleaders in the smuggling networks continues. And so does this. A municipal bulldozer clearing away another informal migrant camp. Tents and mattresses dumped in a skip. Police on standby in case of trouble. But this particular migrant camp was where the Eritreans who drowned on Tuesday were living. The timing of its destruction seems unfortunate at best. With the help of a translator listening on a phone line, I speak to a young Eritrean man who tells me he knew some of those who died, but who still hasn't given up on his own dream of reaching the UK.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What did he say, please?
Okay. He said, of course we feel terrible about this, for all of us who are here, because, you know, these people, they're like our brothers. We're all brothers out here.
So what next for this decades-long, ever-evolving crisis? Olivier Barbarin is the mayor of a resort town called Le Portel, where the bodies were brought ashore this week.
When the weather is good, you can see the English coast from here. And you can imagine how these migrants don't want to stay in France. Some have traveled across Europe on foot. They just want to get to a country where they have family, where they speak the language, and where they know they can find work easily. Here in France, people still welcome the migrants with compassion and kindness. But if this goes on, I think attitudes will change.
My sense is that they're changing already, that people are losing patience with the authorities on both sides of the channel, sceptical that we are anywhere close to a comprehensive solution to stop the small boats and smuggling gangs, and to end the misery that now clings to this coastline like a sea fog.
Andrew Harding reporting there, listening to that report. Rob Laurie, familiar to us on the programme, of course, because of his work on that brilliant BBC4 Radio 4 podcast, To Catch a Scorpion, former soldier turned aid worker. And you, Rob, know very well of that route from Eritrea that we were hearing about there, don't you?
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I think I'm right in thinking these people came from the Keren region of Eritrea, and their usual route, their historical route, was to come through the Canary Islands and into mainland Spain. But there's several routes opened up now across the Mediterranean and up through Europe and into European countries and eventually into France to come to the UK.
But the conditions so bad there that they think it's worth risking that terrible journey to get to the coast and then another one to get here to the UK.
Well, they don't always want to come to the UK. I mean, I've spoken to many of these people in Belgium and Germany and France, and usually they just want to get to somewhere they're safe, where they're accepted as people. The problem is now that the asylum cases are dropping off massively in Europe, have been accepted. And, through over 10 years of investigating this with my colleague Sue Mitchell, what we see in the camps in northern France is that, different nationalities from African nations, from Iran, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, they speak either German or Swedish or Belgium or Danish. And that's because they've been in those countries for 2 and 3 years and they eventually had their second and third appeal denied. So, they're not going to go back to Eritrea or wherever they come from, their host nation, because of why they left. So their only option is now to go down to northern France and once again put their hands into their lives into the hands of these organised criminal networks. And I think it's fair to say now that I have been on this programme quite a few times, and I've been on different media stations talking about the same thing. I think it's fair to say now that this is become a problem that can be solved between governments working together. And I've been saying that, you know, drug dealers will always be drug dealers. Human traffickers will always be human traffickers. You ain't going to stop that.
But what can you do then, Rob? Because when you describe that crackdown that's going on in many countries in Europe, of course, as it gets bad in one place, they try somewhere else. And there is always money to be made in helping them try somewhere else.
But once again, we're looking at the, you know, organised networks. And they are very organised networks that operate these people movements, these smuggling of people. We need to work together as countries. Safe passage, from Europe. I mean, the UK actually are quite low down on the amount of accepted asylum cases in terms of Europe. Germany take a lot. France take an awful lot, but they're always getting battered by different media stations saying they're not doing enough. But we need to really come up with a plan where we can have either safe passage and put them into an area where they can have their asylum cases looked at, either on mainland Europe or in the UK. Because without that, I would be back here. I was on this programme 2 months ago.
Yeah, and you're going to keep coming back, Rob, aren't you? You're going to keep coming back if it carries on like this. And we're grateful for you doing it. By the way, let me just remind people of that podcast. As you rightly said, it's your work with Sue Mitchell. We don't get this written in our scripts, ladies and gentlemen. It is a brilliant, brilliant podcast, To Catch a Scorpion. Please listen to it on BBC Sounds. And Rob Laurie, thanks.
It is indeed. And at 13 minutes to nine, my next guest, I'm very happy to be able to introduce to you, one of the most successful football coaches in the world. Alex Ferguson is a big fan amongst many others. And when she left Chelsea Women to cross the Atlantic earlier this year, she left a big hole in the game. I'm talking about Emma Hayes. She has amassed many domestic titles with that team. And at this summer's Paris Olympics, she guided her new squad, USA Women's National Football Team, to a gold medal.
The USA are celebrating because the four-time gold medalists now the five-time gold medalist. It hasn't been eye-catching football at times from the USA at this Paris Olympic Games, but it's had the grit, the determination of an Emma Hayes side. And after just a couple of months in charge, Hayes has led the USA to success in her first major tournament.
The grit and the determination. Emma Hayes, new head coach of United States Women's National Team and author of a new book, A Completely Different Game, My Leadership Playbook, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back to Blighty.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. The weather's gorgeous this morning.
Many congratulations on the gold. How does that feel?
Surreal. And I honestly pinch myself every day thinking about it. I was with my best mate yesterday and we have talked about this since we were kids. And played out that final in our own playgrounds a million times over. So going to the Olympics, I felt like I'd already been there. It was really, really mad.
I liked your face as you heard the commentary line about your team's football in the run-up to it.
I mean, I don't know what people expect when it comes to those things, but who cares?
But the grit there, you know, that's part of your signature. That's what people talk about with you. And you've written about leadership, but you also, interestingly, in your book, and I mentioned there Chelsea and now America, you talk about leadership being draining, which I found really interesting.
Well, people are draining if you think about it like that. And when you're managing, I know now with even with the US, 20 odd players and then about 45 staff, all of those interactions every day require work. And so often, you know, it's about having to listen to so many different things and absorb that. And that there's a human cost and a human toll, I think, when you are the leader. So it's essential. I'm surrounded with people who are so much better than me, not just in different areas of expertise, but being able to absorb that. Otherwise, I think it's extremely draining.
What's your technique then? What tips could people learn from you about leadership? I've read that you personally appreciate meditation.
Oh, yeah, no, without question, and especially as I age, I realise the importance of, like, making sure that my body doesn't get too heightened too quickly when it comes to preparing for games. And And it's that recognition of what stress is and how you can influence stress with a combination of, you know, just breath work or meditation. And sometimes meditation for me is just 30 minutes of not having to listen to anyone and like being
that's a sort of meditation I could sign up for.
You know, it's brilliant. And I've had a combination of coaches over the years, but I've always thought it's essential for staff. And so often what becomes a focus in sports environments is there's always a focus on what to do for the players, but I think it's equally essential what you're doing for the staff. And
you talked about your body there not becoming too heightened. You've been very open as someone who has struggled a lot with pain. You talked about your endometriosis diagnosis and then having to have an emergency hysterectomy, some time away from the game because of that. Is that something that you found that you were okay with, talking about that sort of stuff publicly? Why did you choose to do it?
Well, because I felt like having gone through years of, you know, undiagnosed and sometimes misdiagnosed situations, suffering in silence for me was probably the worst part, or suffering without knowledge. And I thought, if there's one thing I could use my own platform for, that it could be to discuss the inequalities in and around what's there and available for women. And going through endometriosis up until the point of hysterectomy is something that is so painful for me to reflect on, because being in chronic pain every day is exhausting, and trying to find solutions and self-solve. And that's why I've become so educated in and around, you know, what's best for a woman, is because is that literature is not widely available, that resource is not there. So I had to learn myself.
Well, sadly, I'm in the painful no on that front. So I also appreciate you speaking out about that. How are you now?
Yes, I don't want to advocate, going through a sudden menopause with a hysterectomy, but it certainly relieved me of chronic endometriosis. But then you have the other side of having to deal with what a sudden menopause is, and all of the challenges with the loss of, in particular, I realised the importance of oestrogen to our body, and realising you have to stay on top of those things. So you just have a different set of challenges. But chronic endometriosis is, without question, been the hardest thing I've had to deal with in my life.
The game itself is obviously your joy. It's your passion. It gives you a lot, I'm sure, when you're in a difficult spot with your health as well. But it's still got a long way to go when it comes to women and, you know, people being accepted for their talent, not necessarily their sex. I'm just looking at the fact, of course, the England men's head coach is open. I don't think you're going for that at the moment with a new job. Tell me otherwise. But do you think actually one of the big frontiers is for women to coach the men's team? I know it's about getting more women in generally, but what do you think about getting to that point?
I think you need to get more owners in to ask them that question, because they're the people you have to ask that question to. I'm not the one who's in charge of that.
Do you not think they're ready for that?
You mean the owners?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course they're not. Otherwise, it would have happened by now. But I've said this a million times over. You can find a female pilot, a female doctor, a female lawyer, a female banker. But you can't find a female coach working in the men's game, leading men. Just shows you how much work there is to be done. And that's why, for me, it's about those that are in charge that you have to ask the question to. It's not about whether a coach...
And what do you think it is they've got against women being in charge?
Again, I think you have to ask them that question.
But you're being around the atmosphere of this, being around that, those sexist remarks, those prejudices.
Yeah, just all of those things. I think it's been a place which has, you know, just been, you know, the large majority have been males in that situation. And often people don't think that maybe a female can manage a dressing room of male characters. So
would you relish that in your future, do you think?
I manage about 25 men every day. They're just the staff
players,
I work
the
with.
Players, sorry.
But I never thought the players would be the problem. I think players, you know, they want to be coached, and if there is the best available coach, this happens to be a female, they'll get their head around it just like they did anything else in life.
Emma Hayes, the book's called A Completely Different Game, My Leadership Playbook. Thank you for taking us into your world, and also how to meditate, your style.
You're welcome.
It is now 5 to 9. Some of those who queued online for hour after hour in the hope of buying a ticket to watch Oasis back together again after so long were expected to put their money where their mouth is when they faced a message telling them there were no tickets available at the price that they originally clicked on for. They could instead spend more, a lot more, more than £350 for what were called merchandise tickets, but in fact, exactly the same tickets that had originally been on for half the price. They called it the ticket agency's dynamic pricing, but the band has distanced itself from all that, and the idea has been dropped for sales for two new extra Oasis concerts. What matters, though, is that an inquiry has been launched by the competition regulator, the Competition and Markets Authority. The former legal director at the CMA joins us now, Tom Smith. Good morning to you, Mr. Smith.
Good morning.
What do you make of the practice, and is it a breach, in your view, of consumer law?
Well, it's there's a potential breach of consumer law whenever consumers are misled or whether they're put under undue pressure. So the thing the CMA would be looking at is whether going in a queue for 5 hours and then being told that the price is a lot higher than you expected, whether that would be a misleading practice in breach of consumer law.
That's the key difference, isn't it, from dynamic pricing as it's used, for example, when you use one of those online taxi apps or even booking a plane ticket. You're in the queue for a ticket at one price, and you get to the end of the whole process and they've suddenly changed the price.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, consumer law worries if you're not told the right information. I mean, when you book an Uber, you're told what price that will be. And when you get in the car, they don't suddenly say it's twice the price. Mm. So I think that's where and people don't like dynamic pricing a lot of the time because it offends against their kind of thoughts of fairness. But that can be solved. Well, it's made a lot worse if you're not told the right information.
Mm. And it is an if, of course, the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, were to conclude there'd been a breach of the law, what sort of powers have they got to pursue that?
So for things that happened last weekend, there are no fining powers, but the law has just changed. It's just not enforced quite yet. In the last day of the parliament before the election, they passed the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Act. So the CMA will, from the autumn, have fining powers, pretty big fining powers of up to 10% of worldwide revenues.
But that would apply to future offences, not if this were regarded to be an offence, not for this.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
No. We've got to ask. Emma didn't get a ticket. I didn't get a ticket. Did you try?
No, I queued, although I joined the queue late. It's my own fault.
But there was nothing to be had. Yeah. But your instinct, now you're not speaking for or working for the CMA, is your instinct that this sort of practice should not happen?
Yeah, I think, well, there's dynamic. This is where economists differ from normal people, I think. Economists think that dynamic pricing is an efficient way to allocate between supply and demand. And that's true, of course, to an extent. I think people worry more about dynamic pricing when they're not given a fair chance to pay the lower price, or where the excess profits go to a middleman.
Yeah, well, it's like queuing in a traffic jam, isn't it? Which is, if you're told you're going to be there for 4 hours, you're frustrated, but you're not angry. But if you haven't a clue, then you become angry. Well, thanks for being clear about what the law is and isn't. Tom Smith, former legal director at the Competition and Markets Authority. I'm going to try again.
You are? Okay, well, good luck.
Just keep trying.
I don't know. I